Okay, unless I hear.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming. My name is Rick Algert. I'm the harbor director for the city of Morro Bay. Jay Elder from Port St. Louis Harbor Manager, and our other host is Tom Roth. And where'd you go? There's Tom Roth, the chairman of the Cable Fisheries Liaison Committee. The meeting today is on the draft environmental impact statement of the ground fish management plans. The essential fish habitat is really the emphasis of what we're going to talk about. And I appreciate everybody for coming. It's a much larger crowd than we ever conceived of when we first started talking about this. Just to reiterate, what we're going to do here is we have an agenda, and there are more agendas in back. I have some extras up here. If anybody doesn't have any, I'll try and hand them out when I get off the mic. We're going to have the presenters come up so that it can be on TV, and this will be recorded for those in the audience maybe watching this who would like a copy. I think you can get that from AGP Video. The presenters will be at the podium north. What we have consistently in landings in Morro Bay has always been groundfish, and we have suffered for that over the last 10 to 15 years as the reductions in the groundfish quotas and the seasonal closures. And we are barely hanging on to the infrastructure we have. If there is a further reduction in trawl landings to this port, it may very well be the ending of us as being a viable commercial fishing port. So we are vitally interested in how this essential fish habitat issues play out and the ground fish management plan. Jay, you want to say something?
Very quickly, my name is Jay Elder. I'm the harbor manager at Port St. Louis. Thanks for coming today. Both Morro Bay and Port St. Louis are concerned about the regulations and restrictions that we've seen over the last few years. This environmental impact statement that Pacific Fisheries Marine Council and NOAA are putting together are very important to all of us, the fishermen, as well as the coastal communities. And what the purpose of today's meeting is, and the reason Rick and I are trying to put this together, is to educate everybody in the room and the general public on what this means to coastal communities and the fishermen. The message I think I need to send today is, and this is about the fishermen and coastal communities, today's meeting is, and it's real important for the fishermen to try and understand what it is happening with the essential fish habitat designations and how that might affect your particular fisheries. When Rick and I first started looking at this thing, we were focused on trawling, and that was Rick's main focus here today. We did talk to some NOAA representatives earlier today, and there could be impacts to other fisheries that you want to look at, and those would be the kind of questions you might want to ask the representatives from NOAA today. National Marine Fisheries Service has asked how we can prevent or manage impacts to other fisheries, whether it be longline rockfish, salmon, albacore, what have you. So those are important things. You need to write letters and get the information, your opinions, to National Marine Fisheries Service and Pacific Fisheries Marine Council by the May 11th deadline. We'd also like to thank Nolan and everybody else that's here today to do the presentation. And if there's any questions, feel free to ask Rick or I to help you go through the process. We're here to help you guys. So let us know what we can do to help you write any letters. Thank you.
Tom declined. He's going to stay in the weeds there for right now. So we're ready to go, Steve, excuse me. If you want to get it started there, we're probably going to have a little bit of a break because there's about, I think, three at this point presentations. So after this, there probably will be a little break as it takes a moment or two to set up the next presentation. But, Steve, you want me to introduce you, or are you going to be able to?
Could you turn that microphone?
Yeah, AGP Video will be not shy about telling you exactly. Yeah, so you might as well get used to it. No, I wish. You ready? Okay.
I'm ready. Yep.
Thanks, Steve. Steve Copps came down from Seattle. As I understand it, you are the project manager for the environmental impact statement that has been prepared. And I can't imagine a better source. And I was greatly relieved that you were coming so I didn't have to do this. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks very much for doing this. It's really important. We have not had the opportunity to hold public hearings on this, and my view is that to get the communities involved at this level where you're actually taking ownership is the way that it works best, and I'm really in gratitude to you and Tom and Jay for inviting me and giving me the opportunity. This probably seems pretty formal. I'll sort of walk through these slides, but I hope that it evolves into a pretty free-flowing discussion. I'm here to answer any questions. Feel free to make them tough ones or easy ones as you see fit. Okay, so I'll just launch into this. Essential fish habitat came out of the Sustainable Fisheries Act in 1996, and it requires the fishery management councils to define and describe essential fish habitat and to protect it to the extent practicable from adverse impacts to fishing. So we'll talk more about what to the extent practicable means, but it in general means that we need to have healthy fisheries, healthy coastal communities. So we're looking for the answer of how much protection versus economic impact and so forth. Also included in the law is the need to identify actions to encourage the conservation and enhancement of EFH. So it's not just targeted at fishing, but we consult on federally funded non-fishing activities that may harm EFH. And as was discussed, there's a decision coming out of this environmental impact statement in June 2005. Now, that we're particularly concerned about, and I'll show you the alternatives there. The third is to minimize, to the extent practicable, adverse effects of fishing. I think with the limited time and so forth that we have, that's really what we want to focus on today. That's what affects what could affect your community the most. And then, of course, other actions. So why am I here? It's a large, complex document. It's not extremely readable. It's tough to get through. There's four different types of actions. There's a lot of science in there, both habitat and social and economic stuff. So we'll try to point you through that. And we brought some handouts. One of them helps you. It's just sort of a map to the document. This was developed by some guys at Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And they're over here. It has number 4 up here. And if you just want a map for where to go in the document to get information, that'll help you. So also it's an opportunity to ask questions, have a discussion about what the council should do, and encourage comments. I really think you need to comment. There's a lot of information the council does not have, that the National Marine Fisheries Service does not have, about social and economic impacts, and the only place we can get it is through you. One example of that is information on where non-trawl fisheries fish. In Oregon, in Bandon, we did a meeting, and we didn't know that we had an alternative that would have basically put the town of Bandon out of business. So it's not that we're not interested in that, it's that we don't have the data. So it's just a fact. And when they told us, you know, it would clearly be an impracticable alternative to put that town out of business, we're not interested in doing that. So that was really good information that we got, and hopefully we'll get information from you if there are similar situations. So the EIS, one of the reasons the EIS is large and complex is because we had to consolidate an awful lot of information. This isn't just for the areas outside of your port. This is for the whole coast. And so part of the EIS just gets all the information in one place, and hopefully we'll keep that updated as the council goes through business, so they'll be using it in an updated form years from now. We need to ensure that EFH is capable of sustaining groundfish stocks for fisheries over the long term. So EFH is part of our long-term management solution. It's not, we're not kidding here. You know, we need to protect habitat. We need to find a sensible way to do it. And in addition, that EFH is capable of sustaining enough groundfish to function as a healthy component of the ecosystem. I'm going to skip this one. So the alternatives, there's EFH designation, HAPCs, minimization of adverse impacts. I just want to highlight this number 4 here, research and monitoring. The science on this is better than what maybe we thought it was going into the project, but at the same time, it's very inconclusive. We just don't know a lot about how groundfish or the ecosystem will respond to
either impacting habitat or protecting it. So we need this research and monitoring to improve that situation so we're not in the same place in 5 years or 10 years, that we're getting more information coming in. And it's something the council and NIMS take seriously. There's not a lot of money to do research, but I think we can start focusing on more specific ways to improve our database. So this is the first alternative for EFH designation. It's the whole exclusive economic zone. And this was what the council did in 1998 and is in effect today. That's all EFH out there, everywhere you go. So we did some modeling where we looked at substrate data and bathymetry and the association of fish to habitat and profiled the suitability of different habitats. And the rest of the alternatives are a result of this model. I'm only going to show the preferred alternatives. This is one of them, and it's where there's 100% probability that the habitat is suitable. So it basically just drops off the deep areas. This area in the middle of the coast isn't a problem in the data. That's actually the Mendocino Ridge. And this includes all areas out to 3,500 meters. Merrick, what was that in fathoms? 1,100 fathoms. 1,750. Okay, so somewhere in there. If you take out that association with the depth and just go at 100% suitability for the habitat, this is the map you would get. So again, this is EFH. This would, chances are, with you know the council indicated they choose either that one or that one, and that sets the stage for the actions to come. The next is habitat areas of particular concern, and again, there are no regulatory implications here other than that it's a red flag. And one that has not been designated as preferred, but one that I wanted to bring to your attention, given that you're Californians, is a proposal to designate the areas around oil platforms as habitat areas of particular concern. There's research that shows that there's a lot of rockfish that associate with those platforms, and so that's out there. The council did not designate it as preferred, and I think the sort of the public testimony that they made on it was that they're just not confident that they really understand the proposal or the politics behind it, so that's kind of moving its way through the system. Okay, here's the stuff that really I think you need to focus on. These are the alternatives to minimize impacts to habitat. This is alternative 4.1, and there's a variant of it, 4.2. What they basically are is closing areas that are likely to be pristine because they have not been fished. So this is taking the view that habitat is out there, that's in a pristine condition. Let's lock it down so that there isn't an opportunity to impact it. This particular map would apply to the trawl fishery only. It's based on logbook data. The dark gray area are the areas where we don't have fishing activity recorded. And this would apply to fixed gear because we don't have logbooks for fixed gear fishery. We just took an estimate at the 2,000 meter depth contour, and anything west of there would be closed. Another one here is gear restrictions. Now, this is a real laundry list. I don't think they all make sense, as we've been learning through some of our interactions with constituents. Prohibit large roller gear, prohibit flat trawl doors, limit the length of a bottom long line to 3 nautical miles, habitat-friendly anchoring, prohibit dredge gear, beam trawl, set nets, and dingle bar gear. So actually, this would be, I think, you know, I'd be particularly interested in getting your take on some of these alternatives. The Nature Conservancy, Chuck Cook is here, has an alternative in the mix. This was designated as preferred. The map here shows sort of the outer limits of the project area that they provided to us, and I know, Chuck, you'll talk in detail about this, so I'll keep going. Alternatives 12 through 14 in the EIS. Alternative 12 came from Oceana, and I think Jeff Schuster can talk more about this. Alternatives 13 and 14 are variants on it. Alternative 12, as proposed by Oceana, would close the area shown on the map here to bottom trawling. Alternative 13 would have the same areas, but it would close it to all bottom tending gear. So you would get the bottom long line and pots and so forth. And alternative 14 would close those areas to all fishing. Now each of those, 12, 13, and 14, have been designated as preliminary preferred alternatives. And so that's in June, the council needs to think about, you know, they can mix and match from everything I've showed to come up with the final preferred alternative for the EIS. And I don't know if, Rick, you're going to talk about this later, but there are other constituent groups who are taking this as sort of the starting point in developing a proposal with this in the background. And I think that's a pretty sensible move, because this one has a lot of momentum behind it. It's one to really pay attention to. So research and monitoring, this is a summary. I'm not going to go into any great detail, just to avoid taking focus away from the other things that are important. But additional habitat research, expanding logbook or VMS programs to understand better where impacts may be occurring, and the potential to use any closures that come out of this as the starting point for a research reserve to better understand the effects of fishing on habitat or else removing fishing. And that's all I've got. Rick, do you want me to take questions or just do that as in an informal way later?
Yeah, I think I'm sure there are a lot of questions, and I'm gonna start, because I got to tell you that I got a little lost in there. And there was so much information, and I've been trying to catch up on this. So maybe I could try. Hopefully, I wasn't the only one. So the basic issue is that you're under a deadline to respond with EHF designations, and the DEIS has a number of alternatives. I believe there is a total of 14 alternatives at this point.
14 to minimize effects from fishing. More if you look at the other categories.
But the areas that probably we need to focus on, obviously, as it might impact our community or our fishing effort here, is the alternatives to minimize effects on fishing.
Right.
Okay. I did have a direct question on 12 and 14. Now, are they all the same map? Is that the? If you could show that map again, because I had not seen that yet, and I guess we will hear more. But that, so they're, each one is the same map, just different gear restrictions?
Different restrictions within those areas, but the areas remain the same for 12, 13, and 14.
Okay. And could you explain again the time deadlines? That kind of went by me quick. And
certainly.
How are we going forward with this?
Well, I would. My recommendation is to keep that June council meeting as the primary thing in your mind. The way to get your the way you can get your issues in the mix is by commenting on the EIS, particularly to the council. And so we have a handout there that has addresses on how you make comments. And I would send comments to us and to the council so that you can have those comments available when the council comes together in June. Now, past that, I just...
What we're talking about now, yeah. And you say I'm sorry, this is off subject a little bit, but most other fisheries management plans already have EFH designations.
Yeah, I don't know the status of all of them on the West Coast. I think salmon is under review, and I don't know where we are with the others, though. But it's a requirement of the Magnuson Act to have EFH described and management measures, if necessary, in every fishery management plan.
And I might just speak to the audience, too. If you want to ask questions, it might be good to kind of maybe even come up this way, because AGP is going to make you speak at this mic. So I'm running out of steam here before too long. But one of the big questions that we all have is, if there is one of these alternatives is chosen as basically an EFH designation that will limit fishing in to trawlers, I presume that's really to trawl. Well, obviously, it does depend on gear type of some of these alternatives. Yes, okay. But how can that affect potentially that EFH designation, how will it affect other potential fisheries, like highly migratory species even now, is just starting a discussion, as I understand.
Well, if, for instance, alternative 14 here is to all, would close these areas to all fishing. So for discussion purposes, let's just think about that.
So that would be essentially, that's a marine protected area with no fishing in those areas that is blocked out.
Right.
Okay.
And it's in there as a realistic, at least legally realistic alternative.
Yeah. And I see I got some people waiting, so I'll get out of the way. But and you said that this is a preferred alternative. Could you explain a little bit? So there have been some alternatives, obviously, that the PFMC has shown some more interest in and has indicated that these really should be ones we should pay attention to. How many are those?
That's right. Well, just to this handout with the number 4 in the corner here shows what all those alternatives are. There's a number of them. I showed the ones that I think are most useful for you to discuss at this time, that sort of seem to be the ones you should focus on. What that means when they say they designate as a preferred alternative is these are the alternatives they're really seriously thinking about implementing. This whole process has been in the works for several years now, actually, and I realize that it feels like it's just you're just seeing it for the first time, but it really has... It's not new. We've been doing this quite a while. And anyway.
Thank you, Steve. Just for the audience, there are some handouts over here from NOAA and on the back table there if you want to take some of that stuff home with you and read it. Steve, the question, I have two questions here. You mentioned that this has got a lot of momentum behind it, and can you tell us how that alternative was developed or who the sponsor might be? And then I think it's important to explain to us how we might participate in getting our thoughts and ideas to the Pacific Fisheries Management Council and the timeline for us to do that. And if you could help us try and figure out how to provide input to the process so that our ideas and concerns are well presented and voiced in a timely manner, if you could answer those two questions for me.
Okay, I'd be glad to, Jay. Thanks. This alternative 12 was developed by Oceana, and Jeff is here, like I said before. I think he'll talk about that. Oceana, actually it wasn't called Oceana, but back after we did our first EFH amendment, they sued the government and won. And the court ordered us to redo this analysis, considered new alternatives, and gave Oceana the opportunity to present an alternative to the council and have it included. And so that's what alternative 12 is. It came through that process. In terms of the scientific background behind the alternative, I'll let Jeff answer any of those questions. And then, Jay, your softball question, which I appreciate you asking, is how can you really influence this process? The first thing I want to say is I think you can influence the process, especially on giving us and the council a better understanding of what the social and economic impacts are of any of these proposals. The data, at least for fisheries besides the bottom trawl fishery, is pretty weak, and we need to know. And Merrick Burden is back there. Merrick, will you want to raise your hand just so people see who you are? He is the economist who did a lot of the analysis in this EIS, and so he can answer any questions on that. And he's wide open to hearing more from you, because it's been a frustration that we have sort of the limited data that we do. So we are interested. The handout with the, I think it's the number 2 handout over there, talks about how you can comment, who you send them to, and what the timelines are and so forth. Basically,
consider essential habitat, just a definition of that.
Well, essential fish habitat is where fish, it comes right out of law, feed, breed, spawn, and grow to maturity.
Does it include fish or just the habitat?
It includes all the places that fish need to carry out those basic functions.
Okay. Second, you said you don't have much economic information. Are you going to seek that, or are you just depending on us to provide it?
Well, I think one of the reasons I'm here is to encourage you to provide it. We have all the information that we're either are funded to gather or can gather by law. So we're sort of limited, and Merrick, I don't know if you want to talk about some of the data limits. If you get into the EIS and some of the chapters, it talks about where we're limited in data and some of the reasons for that. Do you have anything specific that you're thinking about?
Okay. But I'd like Derek to identify himself. Thank you.
Steve, thanks for coming. Appreciate you helping all of us try and understand this. My name is Craig Fusaro, and I wear a bunch of different hats, but one of them a couple of years ago was involved with dealing with trying to find areas around the Channel Islands to set in marine protected areas. And I'm looking at this map in particular, and it kind of looks like those little squares and blobs that we did at the Channel Islands, and that reminded me that the council had an ad hoc marine protected area committee at one point. And the closer we get, well, 12 is a marine protected area. It's just not a total no-take and not a marine reserve. But the closer you get to 14, you're into marine reserves or no fishing, no-take zones. And I'm wondering how this draft EIS process meshes with the MPA committee's work. Do they have to comment on this? Is there some formal relationship the MPA committee inserts into this? And then the second thing is, I remember just a couple of days ago getting an announcement from the national MPA centers regarding a national network of MPAs. And this happens to be for groundfish, but they are de facto MPAs. How does that work with the national initiative with MPAs? And how are they going to have to comment on yours? Are you going to have to comment on theirs? How does that work?
I'm going to dodge your question on the national network because I just don't know. That seems to be driven by a separate process. In terms of what's going on with the council, I can speak with some authority on that. The council has that MPA committee, but it has been inactive. I don't think it's formally dissolved, but since they produced two reports, I think, and they were part and parcel of what was used to sort of come develop this EIS. So they were we have. Well, we developed a committee, a scientific committee, to help us develop a risk assessment that guided this. You know, then that was forwarded to the policy committee and worked its way through the system. And that MPA report was part of what the scientific committee had at their disposal when they made recommendations. And then we had review by another committee. Steve Ralston is back there. He's spent a lot of time reviewing these products, and I'm sure would answer any questions. So.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Rebecca Lent, and I'm from NOAA Fisheries. The national MPA network announcement that you got just has to do with that we've reached a certain stage. The National Ocean Service, which is part of NOAA, has the National MPA Center, and their job under the executive order is simply to take stock of all the protected areas that are out there, whether they're created for fisheries or by a state or for whatever purposes, and map them all out. They have no authority to create any new areas. So this is simply mapping them all out so that we're doing a better job of coordinating. And you can see, just looking at these closed areas and what are all our alternatives for fishery management, it's really important for us to know what are the other closed areas that are already out there, whether they're under sanctuary authority or under state authority, whatever. We just want to see what the network is, but they cannot create any new protected areas on their own. Thanks.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Good afternoon. My name is Jeremiah O'Brien, and I represent the Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Organization. And I just had a couple of questions, and not having had the opportunity to ask a couple of the trawlers in the area, but I see a large area hit there in front of Morro Bay. And I was just wondering if they had, I believe that is an area designated for closure in front of Morro Bay that I'm seeing right there. Roger, yeah. And I was just wondering how much consideration was given to, and again, not having consulted with the trawlers, if this is their area. It's a very large area there.
The hardest question here is how much do we really need to close, what different types of, how much of each type of habitat and those kind of things. And we just don't have a solid answer for that. And it's a frustrating position to be in, but we don't You know, there's no model we could produce that tells you if you close X miles of rocky habitat, you're going to get so many more rockfish. Or so. We just don't have that kind of definitive information.
So without that, that puts us in even a tougher position than yourself, if you don't mind my saying so. But another consideration, of course, is that there was just a federal buyback, not federal, a buyback of the trawl industry. So if I'm wondering if maybe a projected numbers was 500 square miles 2 years ago, that number would have changed to a lesser degree because there's less fishermen there. And a lot of this area you're going to close probably isn't fished anyway.
And it
can't be fished in the future because there's no way to access more permits. There's no permits being given out. If anything, the pressure will lessen in the future is through attrition.
Right.
But is there a number or something that we could work with or have some idea?
A number
of where you want to go with
habitat?
With the amount of habitat you're...
Well, nymphs... This will be frustrating to you as well, I'm sure, but NIMS has not articulated a position at this point. This is being worked up through the council, and we're trying to facilitate good thinking on the part of the council, but we don't have a definitive position at this time. So.
Okay, and I'm afraid I did not understand, as far as the highly migratory species, that there is a possibility that these will not be accessible in some of these areas also?
Well, those are in, like, Alternative 14, which would be these areas, would be closed to all fishing. But I think that may not make sense for a lot of these areas. So it's not our intention to do things that don't make sense. I mean, we still need to get to, you know, come to terms with what the final action is going to look like. And I think if there's no habitat benefit to closing a highly migratory pelagic fishery in an area, we're not going to do that. This is primarily focused on the bottom in terms of, you know, any objectives here, because if you just look at it from a perspective of what can be damaged by fishing, towing gear through the middle of the water column isn't going to damage habitat. So it is focused on the bottom.
Okay, thank you very much.
And do you want Merrick to talk about some of the social and economic stuff you brought up?
Yeah. What was your question again? I'm sorry.
I recall you had brought up the issue of burning more fuel.
Oh, right. In front, I see a large closed area in front of Morro Bay. And again, I don't know if our trawlers access that area. So I haven't had a. This is the first I've seen of that. But to close without taking into consideration closed areas in front of a working port, you would then force a vessel of whatever kind to travel further away from port, further away from its traditional
sure.
grounds, and then they'd be burning more fuel, be causing more pollution, using more gear, equipment. It just seems like it would...
Yeah, sure. Those are definitely things we take into consideration in the analysis. But... Again, I mean, we're constrained quite a bit on the economic side, and so a lot of this turns into a qualitative discussion that is similar to what you've just stated. And we do state that within the EIS, that a lot of these will affect travel and travel costs and variable costs and things like that.
When these were drawn up, it was the trawl industry. Did they have a lot of input in designing any of these areas?
I believe Oceana might be in a better position to answer that.
For the other alternatives in the EIS, it was developed through one of the council committees that has industry representatives. I don't know how close they are to your port, but Ralph Brown represented the trawlers on that committee, and we have a long line representative and so forth.
Okay, I
realize
just
it's not perfect, but
I hadn't heard that. Probably every port, if it's going to affect their port, should have trawl representatives. Input. I mean, the input from somebody in Washington or the state of Washington or the state of California, it seems like every port is going to be affected should have the members who are going to be directly affected on board there. So. Thanks a lot. I don't want to take up any more of your time.
Okay, I appreciate the questions.
Hi, I'm Mike McCorkle. I'm the president of the Southern California Trawlers Association, which is a group of small trawlers that fish from. We might not trawl in one area because maybe we catch ridgeback shrimp, we catch halibut, and we catch sea cucumbers in this area of Santa Monica Bay and below Los Angeles, Newport Beach. And there's a substantial fishery there at times. And it's not being recognized here the way I see it. So what we're going to do is we're going to let you know about our experience in fishing in this area, and hopefully you'll respect our experience. We're not scientists and we're not this, but we're experienced fishermen for over 25 years fishing in these areas. So we're going to inform you about the fisheries, and maybe it'll be better for you.
Okay, well, that's why I'm here, to get that kind of information. I'll just tell you, though, in sort of technical speak, this came right out of logbooks, and it was limited to the years 2000 through 2002 to try to capture the time before the regulation really got sort of more severe on the coast. And so it probably didn't address all the concerns it needs to, and getting information would be good.
You know, it's important to look back past those two years there and see what happened in the past when you're talking about closing something or leaving, you know, it open, because it's like these limited entries, you know. They pick a couple of years, and they don't look at a period of years, and a lot of people get out, and we could see in some of these proposals, if they only pick those 2 years and say this is pristine area, never been fished, that's not true. It has been fished, and if we're allowed to fish, it will be fished again in the future. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Well, yeah, Merrick just brought it. Those are just a limited entry trawl log, so other sectors not captured in there wouldn't show up in this. Okay.
Thanks, Steve. I gotta get on my soapbox a little bit before I ask this question. And it's, you know, I mean, the ugly thing on the table here, in a way that we're not talking about, is that trawl fisheries have a bad reputation, bad connotation in a lot of people's minds. And I think a lot of that's based on history rather than current. So I want to say that in this area now, between Santa Barbara and Monterey Bay, we have 5 Class A trawlers who've operated here in recent years, and that's way reduced from past history. That's 200 miles of coastline. We have 5 Class A trawlers. Almost all of them work on 60-day quotas. Well, they do work on 60-day quotas, excuse me, in the deepwater complex. And for the most part, it varies, obviously, because it's fishing, but they catch their 60-day quota in somewhere between 3 and 8 days of fishing effort. So they fish 3 to 8 days out of the 60 to catch their quotas. That extrapolates out. You don't need to be, you know, even I can do the math. There is very little trawl effort that actually occurs in this area, but it still produces the main consistent landings for us. And another point I want to bring up for the public watching as much as anything is that the gear is greatly improved and reduced from what historically a lot of people are told still the old historic methods, or at least the methods of 15 and 20 years ago, the gear is reduced. So my question is there an alternative, since the fishing effort here is quite light, and certainly historical methods, and for 200 miles of coastline, we don't even have a trawler out fishing in that 200 miles most days here. People need to understand that. Most days, there's not even a trawler operating in this 200 miles of coast. At least half, you might say half the days, probably there's a trawler operating to get the landings we need, at least. Is there an alternative that could look just at gear restrictions, and maybe that was that one? I mean, my opinion is if we kept improving the gear, you could certainly, in that way, limit any damage or damage to habitat, and because the gear would limit the kind of habitat that the equipment could be used over, that certainly would. Is there an alternative like that?
Well, there's a couple things. One is, this is version 1 of this. You know, we need to review the whole EFH plan every 5 years. So as gear develops, if that happens, then it can be assessed and implemented to replace things that may come out of this process. So thinking ahead is pretty wise here. I kind of got lost in your question, but I want to go back to your discussion about the trawlers, and reducing effort overall is going to reduce impact on the habitat. There's no question, but and so that's a positive from the habitat perspective. But keep in mind too that there are some sensitive species out there, like deep sea corals, that actually provide habitat and structure. That all it takes is one.
You know, you have the capability to make sure, if the goal is to protect the habitat and make sure that it's not injured, and maybe there is some special habitat that needs to be, you know, just cannot be trawled. But also, you know, improving the gear is a good way to go at it and to potentially still harvest the fish.
Good. I hope that develops.
Thank you, Steve. First of all, I'd like to invite anybody else up before we bring up the next speaker, and I've got two quick questions, Steve. If you could go back to alternative 12 through 14 and maybe identify what the color is. What's the legend here? Is that the pink area is closed or open? Is the gray area open or closed? Or can you explain that to us?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. The dark gray area would all be closed. That is freezing the footprint of the fisheries, as we had in some earlier alternatives.
And the inside line to the coast, how far off the coastline is it? We can't tell at that smallest scale.
I believe it follows the 2,000-meter contour. Is that?
It's the same as
yours. Yeah, so it follows 2,000-meter, which is in fathoms. Sorry, I should know this. Merrick, do you know? No? Well, we'll run
1,000 fathoms.
1,000 fathoms. So. All the colored areas are closed areas. The reason they're colored is there are different methods of coming up with them. The green areas, and there's really just a couple up north, are what we're calling biogenic areas, areas where trawl surveys showed more coral, sponges, or anemones than others.
So just to recap that then, and it's really hard to tell from the audience, Steve, and maybe you could point out where Point Conception is and maybe Monterey or something. There we go.
So that's Morro Bay.
There's Morro Bay. Thank you.
That sort of.
So the white area is all open to fishing, and then it looks like the purple long zone out there, close to the 1,000 fathom, is closed, which would be the Santa Lucia Bank, Davidson, and maybe part of the escarpment. In that area, just for a point of reference. The second thing I'd just like to quickly touch on is we appreciate Rebecca Lint coming all the way from Washington, D.C. here to be here today. Thank you so much. I want to expand a little bit on what she said with regards to marine protected areas. Harbor Commissioner Carolyn Moffitt is here today, and her question has been for the last year is, when the regulations come in, both fish and game and federal regulations, are we taking into consideration when we apply a new, such as the EFS or EFH program, are we taking into consideration not only the marine protected areas, but other restricted areas, the rockfish exclusionary areas, and other regulatory functions that have been in place or have been implemented in the recent. So you have this combination of different regulations, gear restrictions, closures, marine protected areas, and the likes. And are those being taken into consideration with this process?
They are. Yeah. That sets the backdrop for what we need to do. I want to go back to sort of the problems that you're having from the audience perspective and digesting what's in front of you here. I know that you are, and I think the only thing that you can do is to get your hands on these maps that are here. There's materials here to help you. There's no way in 20 minutes or a half hour I can sort of get you tuned into all the complexity and all the details and all those things. That's not going to happen. I'm here to help you sort of figure out where to go in these documents and what questions I think you should be asking. But I really encourage you to roll up your sleeves and get your hands on these maps and think it through and comment or come up with your own proposals. So,
Jeremiah O'Brien again. Steve, I'll be very brief here. But you know, it would be a big help if there was on accompanying, say, these projected closed areas, if there was a color in there that would show, especially the people who aren't familiar with it, what is currently closed. Because I see in Southern California here, a lot of people don't realize that there's huge rock hard conservation areas, including the Tanner Banks, 43 Fathom Bank, the Osborne Bank, like that, and also the shelf closure. So without having that visible, people don't understand the scope of the addition of these. In other words, if you were, say, we went with this, what is shown here today, and then in the future they decided to close a little more, and this was not visible to anybody, and so we closed more, well, pretty soon it would be all closed because you can't see the shelf closure, the Tanner, the all these other areas. So if they were colored in there, it would give a person a perspective of what the final product would actually be. And that, could you go back to alternative 9, if you don't mind?
I'm only talking about California.
Sorry, I'm not
applicable more up north.
Yeah, I don't know anything about theirs, but from a California perspective, a lot of that's already completed. So it might disillusion other people when they see that, going, well, yeah, we should do these darn fishermen, you know, but this has already been done.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that, and I would encourage you to get into the IS and look in Chapter 3, and you'll see maps of all the areas that are currently closed. I only have so much time up here today right now, so I'm focusing on new
proposals. Right. I was more concerned about the people in the audience that might not be familiar, so that I'll give you a good example. I encourage the Blue Ribbon Task Force and these MLPAs that we're facing here in California now to do that. And at a meeting in Monterey, I informed them of the shelf closure. And they all looked at each other up and down and said, oh, that area is closed out there? And these are people on the Blue Ribbon Task Force who were not at that time aware. So if it's a visual thing, then everybody gets a chance to see it, because not everybody is a participant, if you will, in the activity around the coast or in the industry.
So. You're right.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Tom Hafer. I'm a president of the North Shore Trout Association. Are you guys kind of meshing up with the Blue Ribbon Task Force so you know what they're doing at the same time you guys are doing this, what you're doing, so we kind of know, so somebody knows what's kind of going on?
Well, I'm not personally, but California's representative on the council is, and she was on the committee that helped develop these alternatives, so I assume that is going on. To what extent, I can't speak.
So you guys are kind of like a separate entity than them. You're going to do your own thing, and they're going to do their own thing, and then whatever we have left, we have left?
I wouldn't put it that way, but the representative of the council from California is charged with bringing California issues to the council and making sensible recommendations and decisions, and so she is clearly aware of that. That's one of the most important marine initiatives in California or on the coast. So,
So this is going to affect inside state waters too?
There are both state and federal water proposals here. That's right.
So that like the nearshore fishery that has a management system already, and the spot prawn fishery that already has a management in place, you're gonna look at those fisheries and decide against them too, where they can fish and where they can't fish.
Well, there are proposals in here that could impact those fisheries, and we can, if you want to talk to Merrick or Susan Ashcraft is here from the state, may have some good answers for you, but whether or not those get implemented is another story. Mm-hmm. But those proposals, there are proposals here that can impact those fisheries.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, if there's no more questions for Steve or any of his staff, they are available, and they will be at a break here shortly. We'd like to thank you, Steve, for traveling all this way today and bringing your staff with you, and we appreciate all the representatives from NOAA here today.
Thank you.
Thank
Appreciate
you for all you've done to try and educate us today. The next presenter is Chuck Cook from the Nature Conservancy, and he's got Mary Gleason, Senior Planner of the Nature Conservancy, to help him today. And the Nature Conservancy has an alternative. I believe it's listed as alternative 10 in the EIS. The Nature Conservancy has developed maps that are on the back table here. If you've taken a chance to look at them, if not, you may. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Cook and Ms. Gleason. Thanks for coming today.
Thanks, Jay. My name is Chuck Cook. I'm the director of the Coastal and Marine Program for the Nature Conservancy. And also, I have two of my colleagues here today, Dr. Mary Gleason, who is a senior conservation planner and a marine scientist, and in the front row, Matt Merrifield, who is a GIS specialist and also now local surfer of Morro Rock as of this morning. The Nature Conservancy's interest in the Essential Fish Habitat Project is really twofold. First of all, we're interested in trying to look, kind of step back from the Essential Fish Habitat process and look at new approaches that may help find solutions to some of these thorny issues that we've been hearing about protecting marine habitat, and in particular, protecting seafloor habitat and benthic habitat. Secondly, while we attempt to look at these new approaches, we aim to work closely with the permit holders. There's in the Central Coast, there's 22 fishermen who own Class A trawl permits, and warts in it. And we'd like to see if there's a way to merge those two together in hopes of getting a better product. So our presentation today is going to be two parts. Mary Gleason is going to describe to you and walk you through briefly the process that the Nature Conservancy goes through when we try to collect data and identify priority marine habitats, bearing in mind that it's only half the loaf because we don't have the fisherman information. And then secondly, she's going to share with you some of our products to date and where we are in that habitat mapping process. And then after Mary finishes, I'll update you on the Nature Conservancy's Alternative 10 in the Essential Fish Habitat EIS, and then try to further explore a joint mapping exercise on a more local and regional level.
Thank you. So I'm going to talk a little bit today just about how TNC approaches our work. The Conservancy really relies on conservation planning to help us figure out where the priority conservation areas are and where the diverse and valuable habitats are. And we've recently completed a regional scale assessment of the area from Oregon all the way down to Point Conception, the Northern California Current region. And that included the Channel Islands and the offshore seamounts. And we collected a great variety of data on seafloor habitats, other kinds of habitats and species in that region, and really tried to identify areas of biodiversity and conservation importance. And this is basically, you know, how we arrived here at the Central Coast, because, as you know, this is an area of very diverse seafloor habitats. There's three major upwelling zones in this region, very productive fisheries, just a real wealth of marine diversity. And that's, you know, why we're focusing in large part in this Central Coast area. So the project that Chuck is going to talk more about pretty much extends from the area from Davenport down to Point Conception. And the Conservancy, you know, has a consistent approach that we take, whether we're working on land or in the sea, for really identifying areas of conservation importance. And that's to, as a first step, identify the important habitats, ecosystems, and species that we really think represent that region's diversity. We call those conservation targets, or the things that we're really focusing on. We then compile all of the data that we can in terms of their distribution, and we make maps to show where these habitats and these species are located. And then we set conservation goals for each one of those as a percentage of their total amount. So, for example, you know, looking at all the kelp forests up and down the coast, we might set a goal of, say, 30% or 50% or some number for the amount of that type of habitat that we think is the most viable, the best occurrences, and the amount that should be conserved. And then we really go through a process of identifying the areas where we see a high abundance and diversity of our targets. So we're looking for a lot of overlap of the distribution of habitats and species that we care about. And so we've gone through a process of doing just those steps here along the Central Coast. And so, you know, one of the first group of targets and the most important to this EFH process, of course, is the seafloor habitats. And we're really, at this point, limited to regional data that's readily available. And this comes from the California Continental Shelf Mapping Project. And there's, you know, a variety of data sources in it. But, again, it's very regional. It's not real site-specific. But it identifies general rocky and soft-bottom habitats, canyons, ridges, slopes, things like that. We also include things like seamounts and offshore banks that we know have high biodiversity and high habitat value. We have a variety of other conservation targets that we've included in our assessment of this region. This is just a short list of them. And all of these maps that are here on the screen, I know they're a little bit hard to see. We also have them on the side on the table, so you're welcome to go up and take a closer look at them, and we can talk more about them. But we've compiled all of the readily available data on the distribution of kelp forests, estuaries, deep-sea corals and sponges, these upwelling zones, which we've mapped based on sea surface temperature during the upwelling season. The nearshore canyon has these places where these deep canyons come quite close to shore, often very rich areas. So we've got those mapped. The shelf slope break, which we've identified in a general sense as the 200 to 300-meter contour, is also another area that's been, you know, through extensive research shown to be important for regional diversity. There's a lot of fish and invertebrate species in that narrow band. And then generally just areas of what we call bathymetric complexity, or places where there's a lot of complexity in the seafloor, a lot of changes in depth and topography over a short distance. Those are areas where fish tend to congregate, where you tend to see, you know, more species present. So we've got a, you know, quite a long list. This is just an example list of these conservation targets that we've looked at in this Central Coast region. And then the next step is we really try to put all of those where we're really hoping to be able to work with you to look more closely at the data that we've got and to gather data from local experts and really, you know, try to fine-tune these maps and figure out really where are the important areas for conservation value. And just one final point along these lines, and that's, you know, some of these sites are unique and rare. I mean, there's, you know, only one Santa Lucia bank out there. There's only one large bank in this area. There's, you know, very few estuaries. So some of the sites are unique and quite, you know, rare in this stretch of the coast. Other areas are, you know, more broadly found. There's, you know, soft sediment in large expanses. So any one area of soft sediment is not necessarily much more important than another, just based on this regional data that we have. And that's, you know, again, where we would need more local knowledge and local understanding of where the high productivity areas are in soft bottom habitats, for example. So, you know, again, we're just putting this out there as a map that shows our regional analysis, and we'd really like to work together with you to try to make it more of a local local knowledge map as well.
Thank you, Mary. As Steve Copps mentioned, the Nature Conservancy has proposed an effort that is designed to help minimize adverse impact of fishing gear on essential fish habitat in the Central Coast, and it combines the two management techniques, really, and one is the establishment of no-trawl zones, and secondly, the use of a buyback program to reduce effort. I want to emphasize when I say no trawl zones, what I really mean about that, and this is our proposal, is that it would strictly, in the areas set aside, would prohibit dragging and bottom trawling, and that's it. There are some, I think, unfounded rumors swirling around that our alternative would close these areas to other types of fishing, and that's clearly not the intention, nor the case, nor our proposal. I think we have a two-tiered, really, proposal. One is to protect seafloor habitats that have yet to be trawled, areas that are still maybe like they were a long time ago or intact, and we don't know exactly where those are. And then secondly, to protect areas that have previously been trawled and take a look at the recovery process or restoration process that might be involved with that. I think it's the Nature Conservancy thinks it would be a very unique opportunity to have industry and NOAA Fisheries and the conservation community join forces and help design and fund a research effort to look at what happens when you remove trawling from some of these areas. What kind of recovery or restoration, if any, do you have? How long does it take? What does it look like 10 years from now? So that's a big part of our proposal, is to remove some effort in areas and do some research. Over the past 18 months, I have been meeting with 22 permit holders in Avila, Morro Bay, Moss Landing, Monterey, Half Moon Bay, and Pillar Point to discuss the idea of the buyback program and the establishment of the no-trawl zones. We've also discussed very clearly that part of this project is establishing trawl zones as well, trawlable areas, so that the residual fleet would have an economically viable fishing grounds to stay in business. Of the 22 permit holders that I've been talking with, we're now in pretty serious discussions with 14 of 22 about the acquisition of their trawler assets and a number of their permits and a number of the trawl vessels as well. And as Steve mentioned a few months back, the Pacific Fisheries Management Council did select this alternative as one of the preliminary preferred alternatives in the environmental impact statement. Now, over the course of this time, the Nature Conservancy has encountered negative feedback and concerns from the fishing community about this proposal, from Harbor Masters and Commercial Fishing Association. One of the primary concerns is the negative impact it would have on fish buying stations, in particular here in Morro Bay, with the yet again another reduction in the trawl fleet. I've heard those concerns, and I acknowledge them, and I can tell you the Nature Conservancy is interested in learning more about it and trying to find out if there are ways that we can work with Jeremiah and the Morro Bay Commercial Fishing Association, Harbor Masters, and others, and address them. I'm also very aware that ice is a big constraint in the southern part of the region here, and that other alternatives and options to try to reach the same goals of protecting seafloor in the central coast of California. And our response has been, yes, we are willing to consider other options, with one caveat, and that is that we retain the right to continue to pursue the buyback program, especially if other options are not successful. But we are willing to discuss other options. In fact, one option we discussed with the Central California Cable Fisheries Joint Liaison Committee a few months back was the idea of downloading plotters from the trawl vessels, taking that information and trying to aggregate it and to try to camouflage an individual's proprietary information, but aggregate that information of the fleet and display it over habitat maps and see what it looks like. And then sit down with the fishermen and the Nature Conservancy and perhaps others and see if we can't find some common ground. One of the things I hear often, if not always, from trawl fishermen I talk to is that there is a big misconception about how much of the continental shelf and slope is actually dragged and how much is fished. The number that I hear, 15, 18, 20%, is what the fishing community tells me. And some other environmental community members will say it's much larger than that. So it might be time to sit down and figure this out once and for all. I mean, the end game that we would have on a second option, I think, is to try to come up with some precise information, whether it downloaded from the plotters or whether it comes from the fisherman's mind, and sit down and map some of these areas. And as Steve Copps noted, the June deadline is coming on pretty quick, and there's some deadlines staring us in the face. And it seems to me that if we're going to pursue one of these options, we're going to have to move pretty fast. What I would suggest in a put on the table today is that we select a subset of this project area that we're looking at in the Central Coast, perhaps Point Conception to Point Sur, and sit down with the trawl fleet that operates in that area, and that would be David and Chris and Randy and Bill Diller, Barry and Bill Ward, if he wanted to join us, and sit down at the table. And let's look at the critical areas that need to sustain that fishery, and let's look at our habitat priorities and see where they line up and see if we can't protect a little of both. And if we were successful with that pilot project, then we could move up the coast and try to replicate it from Point Sur to Pillar Point. So that concludes my presentation today, and Mary and I will be glad to ask and answer any questions.
Hi, I'm Hugh Thomas. I'm the Vice President of the Port San Luis Commercial Fishermen's Association. I've been fishing in California commercially since 1947. Unfortunately, it wasn't. Maybe it's fortunately I didn't fish all that time, because I'd have been dead by now. But I have seen changes on the coast. I've worked on the coast all the way down. I supervised the area from San Mateo County to Santa Barbara County with the Fish and Game Department for 10 years in the enforcement branch. I'm not a great commercial fisherman. I don't bring in large amounts, but I have seen how important the commercial fishing is to particularly this central part of California. And Chuck, we've had some conversations, and I feel that I know you, and I know a lot of your fellow employees. And I've got about five questions, and I don't expect them to be answered now, but there's something I feel, and it just sort of got to me, and I said, these things I would like to have answered. What about the consumer and the economic impact on the coastal communities? You have talked about that, but no one comes up with any answers. But that's something which is really important, not just the fishing people here, but the people that come to the coast to eat fish and so forth. Are we going to have to rely on Thailand, China, and various other locations?
Can I answer that?
No, I just you can answer it, but I want to get through with these so we don't get into it. Because when I start rambling on, I've got to follow what I wrote down here. Number two, what are the that we have run across at the time, and the ideas about what you want to do. And I hope that it's not that the end justifies the means of what you're getting at.
I'm just going to respond in general, I think, to the first question, Hugh. But I talked to some other fishermen at lunch today about the idea of, if the fishing community and conservation community got together and had a Central Coast trawl plan. The underpinnings were trawl zones and no trawl zones. And I could see, following from that, a ground fish, I don't want to call it certification right now, but there's enough conservation practices in place where there's a ground fish certification plan where ground fish caught by the residual fleet of trawlers, by the hook and line guys, and other people that are catching ground fish. If we had an area conservation plan, I think you'd find the Nature Conservancy, Environmental Defense, the Monterey Bay Aquarium, seven other groups getting behind this and saying, this is a good fisheries plan. Let's try to certify it as environmentally sustainable. Let's see if there's premium prices to be had in the market. So there's any number of ideas that can flow from the idea of us getting together and agreeing on an area-based management plan. Something similar to what was just tossed out. And back to Hugh's question about who I'm going to talk to, and one person says this, the other says this. I think I was pretty clear that I wanted to talk to Randy and Chris and Bill and David.
More people than that, though.
I agree.
Afternoon. Again, Jeremiah O'Brien, Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Organization. Afternoon, Chuck.
Good afternoon.
A lot of this, you're aware of some of what I have to say, Chuck, you're already aware of, and it's a lot of it's for the audience. I move in one direction in the fisheries. All of the fisheries, even though the fisheries are different, have a symbiotic relationship with each other. They all rely on each other for one thing or another, such as dock space, unloading facilities, shore-based facilities, for instance. And given the numbers, 22 trawlers currently working in an area of approximately 300 miles from Point Conception to Half Moon Bay. That's approximate 300 miles. Reduction in the fleet of 14 would leave 8. Where I'm going with this is if that would leave approximately 2 to a port. If we had 2 trawlers working in this port, our dock would close the day that happened. I can guarantee you that. The very day would shut down. Not much has been mentioned about economics here, and I am not, I don't want anybody to misinterpret me, because I'm not trying to put economics ahead of science, but there is a relationship in there is a balance, I should say, that can be achieved with the economics and science. And Morro Bay is extremely dependent on commercial fishing, and with a small loss in one area, given what has happened through all of the management that's been done up to present, would destroy a significantly weakened infrastructure that exists today. Morro Bay, as a city, I'm representing the Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Organization, but I have a great deal of concern for the Central Coast of California. All of California, Central Coast, is our home, and I have a great deal of concern for its well-being. The tourist industry is a big industry in this town, and a lot of the tourists come here because we have fishing here. They love it, and it's a big draw for this town. So it would affect the tourist industry, it would affect the men and women in the area that work on the docks. There'd be, now, when they are put out of business, there is not an alternative. It's not like, okay, I'll go in town and unload fish. No. Their job is ended. Their alternative then would be to move to the north or move to the south to somewhere else that they would find that type of employment. So I don't think enough. The cable committee did a terrific job. And Chuck, you did mention what these areas, you know, if there was this close, what these areas would look like in 10 years, and I am equally concerned what this area would look like in 10 years. So, thanks.
Good comments, Jeremiah.
I'll just, do you want the compliments or do you want the concerns first?
Compliment taken. Now fire away.
I'll give you the compliments first then. Okay, the compliments are, personally, I've always enjoyed and respected what the Nature Conservancy has done on the land. I think they do a tremendous job purchasing up land for conservation. Always been a fan of them. Also, I really have to give you praise for taking a scientific look at the essential fish habitat, certainly more scientific than the coastline out to 3,500 meters. So thank you very much for that. Okay, now I'm going to get into the concern, and I don't need to repeat everything Jeremiah said. He did a very good job of explaining my concerns. But with good science, we need good economics also, and realize that your fish buyout is more economic, has more economic range than just the fishermen. It's more economic range than when you purchase a piece of land for conservation. You know, it does have to do with them. You know, if you take 18 boats out of the fleet, the marinas are going to be impacted. The fuel docks are being impacted. The employment in the area is impacted at some very significant levels. You know, in Ventura, when I'm looking at our squid operations running well, I'm looking at some people who are working, making a reasonable living. Who otherwise may or may not be employable people. They're not people who look like you, for example. And this is a very important phase of employment for those people. So again, I really kind of discourage you from just doing the boat buyout. It sounds good and fair, and is good and fair for the fishermen if they want to do it. But it really has a lot of strong and far-reaching economic impact.
Yeah. Thanks for your comments.
Don't go away, Chuck. But we got to do something here. Steve, you want to come get your computer? Some of the NOAA folks, NOAA Fisheries folks, are going to have to leave. So we're going to do a little switch here. I'm hoping, Chuck, you might stay. If there's any other questions, it'd probably be good to come up. I'm also going to echo a little bit before you go away what Scott said too. I've appreciated that Chuck has reached out to us and is willing to work with us on this. He knows I've been very skeptical of what I've heard from these alternatives, and that I think that it is flawed in some ways, but he genuinely seems open to working with us, and I do appreciate that. I think we would be wise. We're not doing real good all by ourselves in some of this. The trawlers could speak better to that than me, maybe, but we certainly would be a stronger proposal with a partnership, and this it would be something we should, in my opinion, really look at if it were possible. Also, I wanted to say something too, because I think the NOAA folks are going to leave. I'm really glad you all came, and thank you very much, especially Rebecca and Steve Ralston here. Somebody else in the community is probably going to be glad you came, because the NOAA folks were huddling before the meeting and back in the picnic area, and they found a ring. So if somebody's watching on TV here in a couple of days and you lost a ring that might have ended up in the picnic area of the Vets Hall on Friday, give me a call at the harbor office, or it'll be at the PD. But I suspect we might find the owner this way, so thanks for that, too. Yeah, I didn't want to describe it too much. But I think you're right, Don. Thank you very much. So if there was any more questions for Chuck, I'd prefer not to take a break. Otherwise, everybody's going to be tempted to leave. Some of the NOAA Fisheries folks will leave. Otherwise, if you want, we'll try and roll into the next and keep moving here. Thank you very much, Chuck and Mary, also, for coming. Jeff, I'd get you to, Jeff Schuster also, he's not on the agenda, but he has Oceana, has one of the alternatives in the DEIS. They also have been kind enough to send somebody down, and we, of course, give them an opportunity to make a presentation on their alternative. Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks, Rick. Again, my name is Jeff Schuster. I'm currently a doctoral student at Stanford University, based out of Hopkins Marine Station in Monterey. I grew up in the Southern California coast. This is kind of coming at folks from the last minute, and it may be a bit surprising. There's definitely a lot of uncertainties and things that are not made clear. And my goal right now is basically to try and present what the Alternative 12 is and what it's not, what the goals of it are, how it was put together, and hopefully engage in some dialogue. We've been engaged in dialogue with fishermen about this for the last 3 years, about this alternative. And we hope to continue that process here today and in the future. Basically, where we started is in 2002, a congressionally appointed National Research Council study on the effects of trawling and dredging on seafloor habitat concluded that bottom trawling does reduce the complexity, productivity, and biodiversity of the seafloor, and that this reduction, these adverse impacts are most severe in areas of low natural disturbance. These are areas of hard bottom and areas that have living structures like corals and sponges. I work with Dr. Rob Dunbar at Stanford, who's actually aged some of the deep sea corals found off this coast to be in the thousands of years old. These are living corals. So it's these areas where the damage is irreversible where we need to be most concerned. And they recommended a combination of trawl effort reduction, permanent area closures to trawling, and conversion of trawl gear to other gears. And this is coming from the National Research Council report 3 years ago. In addition, over 1,100 scientists last year signed a statement where they basically compared the corals off the coast off the coast here and throughout the world, these deep water corals, to shallow water tropical coral reefs. And we all know that, you know, coral reefs in the tropics are some of the most abundant, rich, diverse areas and important for fisheries. And these 1,100 scientists from renowned universities throughout the world agreed that the deep water corals, cold water corals, are as equally important both to fisheries and biodiversity. So our basic goal is to figure out a way to protect habitat, particularly these important areas identified by the science, while maintaining the vibrant fisheries off the U.S. Pacific coast. And as you can see here, this is a picture of a hydrocoral taken off Monterey that actually has fish eggs attached to the hydrocoral itself. There's an area off Big Sur Bank with hydrocorals and anemones that's just teeming with fish. And basically, the idea is, as far as the long-term health of the ocean, fish don't just come out of nowhere. They don't just appear. There's a lot of ecology that goes into the production of fish. Juvenile fish need places to hide in order to survive to become adults. Adult fish also need places like that. They need resting areas, places to feed. And what we found in the scientific research that we've done, I personally have done a scientific literature review of over 200 scientific papers on this topic, is that biogenic habitats are likely some of the most important areas and the most vulnerable to trawl impacts. So what we basically did from a scientific perspective is gather five sources of data and information to figure out where area closures ought to be. And I want to say, first of all, that area closures are one part of this more comprehensive alternative that also includes other management measures as well, which I'll discuss in a second. But since obviously most of the attention is on area closures, I want to point out also that the closures we proposed are to bottom trawl gear only and do not apply to other fixed gear types and or recreational gear types. Alternatives 13 and 14 were not proposed by us, and we do not support the adoption of alternatives 13 and 14 because specifically this alternative was designed based on trawl data and the science regarding bottom trawling. So I want to make that very clear off the get-go. So NOAA, some of the work Steve Kopp's team did in this process identified all the areas of hard substrate, rocky reefs basically off our coast. And some of these, this is just an example map right here, you can see in these gray areas, I guess it's not showing up too clearly, but has a he basically, this database showed all the areas along the coast that had that hard substrate. Second, there's a database from the trawl surveys, everywhere where the trawl net got hung up. These are areas where they actually ran a bottom trawl and set it, and the gear either got tangled or was lost or got caught on something that was hard, rocky, whatever. So these are trawl hangs, and we got a full identification of all those areas on the coast. And here you can see that there's an area in purple on the lower right here. This is one of those areas identified. This area actually that we're looking at is just an area off Oregon. Third, we used also from NOAA's work the highest 20% habitat suitability for the overfished species. So we're looking at areas where we know that the top and several other data sources that I mentioned to show all the areas on the coast where we know that we have large structure forming invertebrates. These are essentially the corals, large corals and sponges off the coast. And you can see that there's it's pretty widespread throughout the coast. coast. And what we did is, rather than say let's protect everything and you know no bottom trawling anywhere, what we tried to do is focus these down and identify the areas where that had some of the most records and the areas where we had the highest certainty that some of these benthic habitats are there. And so at the same time, what we try to do with very limited data is figure out where the money is being made, where the fish are being caught. We look through the logbook data and fish ticket data to figure out which areas economically are more important, and did our best to try and thread the needle, as it were, to protect the areas where we know that there are sensitive habitats, yet minimizing the economic impact that may result from those closures. And so basically the alternative identifies the trawl footprint, which is the area in green, as areas that is open, that will remain open to bottom trawling. These are areas where this footprint was based on the data we received from NOAA. And within those areas, the five criteria I talked about where the corals are the areas shown in pink. So those are the areas within the trawl footprint that would be closed to trawling in this alternative. Off California, this is the same map that Steve showed earlier. It's just a little bit more detailed, and we can go into looking at some of these areas in more detail if you'd like. But basically, we've identified several areas. Please note that some of these areas are completely outside the footprint to begin with, namely some of the seamounts and also the Calcod Conservation Area in the south. These are areas in pink where we have data to show that there are corals and sponges and other hard rocky reefs in these areas. And at the same time, areas where we, based on the data we had, which is unfortunately at the time we did this proposal at a 10 by 10 minute block resolution, which is obviously not ideal, areas where there's going to be less economic impact. And essentially what we've been doing since then is trying to figure out with some additional data how we could even do better at that. Further reduce this economic impact while at the same time maintaining the integrity of the approach and still protecting some of these areas. I'm going to talk just briefly about the local region here, and zoom in kind of on the part of this alternative that affects the Morro Bay area. This analysis was done on the Oceana alternative by the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. And so you can see here are two of our proposed trawl closed areas in the blue hash lines. One, I called it Morro Ridge, but also known as Santa Lucia Bank. So these are the areas that we've proposed to be closed. And these areas and all these dots over here are areas from the logbook data where the set points and the end points of trawl tracks were recorded. So basically, the gray lines connect start point to end point, and so and this analysis was done throughout the entire coast. And so we didn't know any of that information at the time that these lines were drawn that are currently in the draft EIS. We did not have access to this information. We still don't have access to anything except the picture of this, so we can't actually do any real data analysis on it ourselves, unfortunately, because of confidentiality requirements. But what this basically showed is that, okay, a large part of this area in the north was fished very lightly. This is for the year 2003, but hopefully we'll be able to get additional data on this. And as you know, this data we recognize is not perfect either, and hope to work and talk to some of you about actually what's really going on here. But this is at least getting better for us. It's getting a little bit less foggy, but it's still a little bit unclear. But we see this area on the south part as a really key area where there's been quite a bit of trawling. and this is from in 2003. So the basic process that we're going through right now and are continuing to go through, and hopefully this the meeting today can help with this, is how do we adjust some of these areas to maybe pick up some of the areas of corals that we missed where there's light fishing effort, and at the same time trade those off for maintaining some of these economically important areas, making sure that we're not putting people out of business, that we're not completely shutting this fishery down, because we do know that the fishery has gone through significant changes and is in a more weakened state relative to the last several decades. So these pink areas here are areas where coral has been identified. Those are either corals and sponges identified by trawl survey tracks there. So you can see that the alternative does a pretty good job at protecting this large, hard substrate feature and at the same time protecting these corals. But notice what we've been able to do is say, wow, we really haven't seen much coral come up in a bottom trawl there, but we know that there's a lot of trawling there at the same time. So why don't we kind of thread the needle a bit and reduce the economic impact? And so On a course scale, the current proposal, based on several economic analyses that have been done, is that the current proposal that alternative 12 on the table closes areas that encompass about 20% of the historic value or economic dollars from the trawl fishery, and that doesn't mean that basically has been defined as displaced revenue as the word for it. But basically, as we want to point out, our proposal does not reduce the quota at all. So therefore the total amount of fish doesn't have to go down that are caught. The revenues do not have to be decreased. But what this does mean, I think, as Jeremiah pointed out, is that the cost of fishing may increase a bit because fishermen may have to go to different areas, and that's what we're trying to minimize here. But we feel that based on this analysis and by really looking closer at more spatially resolved data, where you can take a closer look at this rather than by these huge 10-by-10-minute blocks, what we'll be able to do is really decrease the economic impact of protecting a lot of these areas. I want to show hopefully this will work. If it doesn't, I guess. Oh, well. Anyway, I have a video that I can show. Okay. Well, basically, off the Channel Islands this last year, a team of scientists were out there in submersibles, and they discovered a completely new... Oh, here we go. This is a completely new species of coral that was not known to human beings before this discovery. This is they named the coral Christmas tree coral based on all the different life that was attached to it, like Christmas tree ornaments. And this is a species actually of black coral. Some black corals have been dated to be in the thousands of years old. This one's likely in the centuries old category. And Mary Oklovich, one of the scientists on this cruise, basically commented that the reason this is still here is because trawl effort in this area off the Channel Islands has been very light, if any at all. So there is value to protecting these areas that we have not yet explored. There are still things we don't know that may be very important. You can see all these fish in here. Milton Love identified some of those fish to be widow rockfish, which, as you know, are one of the overfished groundfish species here. And these are juveniles. And this basically can attest to the importance of protecting some of these areas, particularly protecting areas that have not been trawled yet. And I want to finish up by mentioning some of the other components of our alternative. We basically agree with many scientists, fishermen, and many people involved in this process that we do need to get better information about this. I know you heard Steve Copps talk about that we do have quite a bit of information, but we still have a long way to go. Part of our alternative itself actually is the implementation and funding for vessel monitoring systems, increased funding for at-sea observer programs, ecological studies and actual habitat mapping using submersibles and better mapping techniques than actually a research trawl survey, which is obviously not the best way to figure out the locations of some of these habitats. But it's the best data that's out there right now, unfortunately. But basically, these components are going to be essential to our ability to really do a better job at this and to maintain our fisheries. And I do also want to mention that, and you can read this in the packet about our alternative, that the alternative also does include a maximum foot rope size, as suggested before, as well as the establishment of a process for creating incentives to do a better job at avoiding some of these areas that contain corals and sponges. So incentives within the areas that remain open. We know we didn't get every single coral that's out there in our closed areas. And I would say I appreciate what Steve Kopp said about the momentum that this proposal does have. And I actually would say that a lot of that is because of we have legitimized the economics and the cultural values of fishing. We're not just out there to protect the environment at any cost. And what we're trying to do is be reasonable and take into account the things people tell us and basically include that in our alternative. And that's what our intention is, and that's what I hope to plan to do today. And feel free, I'll have plenty of cards to send me an email or come up to me afterwards and discuss this more one-on-one. So thank you again. I'll take any questions.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff. Yeah, there's questions, and we probably better get moving for too long. So if you got a question, come on up, Mike. Or she really, Mike. Okay. Well, you didn't know. Please come up.
Hey, Jeff. I'm Mike McCorkle from Southern California Trawlers. I have one question. I see that your alternative and I think the Conservancy's alternative, it looks like a complete closure of Monterey Bay. Is that right? A complete closure.
Based on the alternative that's in the EIS right now in the draft, all the area encompassing Monterey Bay is proposed closure, the entire thing, to bottom trawling. But we are currently considering ways to make that work better, as I said before, because the data that we had to propose that closure was not as good as the data that we have now.
So you're aware of the summer halibut fishery on the north side of the bay from Santa Cruz to Moss Landing in shallow water?
We have recently been made aware of that fishery.
Some of our members, and some are in this room, fish there, and it's an important fishery, mainly from the 1st of May to the end of September. And what I see, your alternative completely closes that down, and that's going to affect, there's a small number of small boats, a couple of them from Santa Cruz, a couple from Moss Landing, and some from down here, the fish there. And my knowledge of that area, I don't see corals and sponges, I don't see rocks, the nets are light, there's no big rollers, I don't see any problem. And I think we should get together and work on leaving that area open.
Well, I'd be more than happy to talk with you about that after this. Thank you very much.
Well, if any of you jump up, otherwise we're going to move on. And I think, all right, Don, come on up. It's all right.
Yeah. I don't have a question, but it's a question for me. All these fishermen you talk to, have they told you that they fish over coral? It seems to me every fisherman I know would go the other direction if they knew coral was there.
Well, many people do claim the same thing that you've claimed
as well. They find where it is, shred their net, and I wouldn't go back there. Do these other guys?
Well, I there's many different types of fishermen out there. I do want to say
everybody's interested in trawlers.
Right. So there are many types of trawlers out there as far as attitudes, et cetera. As I said, most fishermen I talk to have a very strong conservation ethic.
It's not conservation. It's the net doesn't go good over coral.
Right. What we've seen from some from observer data, preliminary observer data from here, this coast, as well as a quite an extensive observer program for some of the Alaska trawl fisheries, is that there is a significant amount of coral that is caught in the nets, that is pulled up and measured by fisheries observers. Whether that's intentional or not is, you know, I don't know. And many fishermen do claim that, you know, their intention is to avoid it. The main strength of the area closures we propose is that we have identified areas where we know this stuff is, and prevent fishermen who may not have gone there before from exploring that area, which we see that the expansion and this exploration of new areas with trawl nets is probably one of the ways that a lot of this coral is destroyed in the first place. Because as Steve Kopp said, it really only takes one hit a lot of times to destroy something that may live for hundreds to thousands of years.
My name's Bill Ward. I'm a local trawler from Port San Luis. I've been doing it since about 1970. I'm one of the people that Mike McCorkle was referring to. When I leave this building, I'm going to get in my car. My boat's in Moss Landing. I'll be dragging halibut in that particular spot tomorrow morning.
We'll try and incorporate and respond to that, and hopefully we could talk after this meeting individually about the specific areas you're referring to. But we came here to listen, and I've taken lots of notes, and we do hear what you're saying, yeah. So I appreciate it.
Okay. Yeah, like Don just said, when we run into something with the nets, then you got two or three days of non-productive time, this, that, and the other. We only try to hit those places once in our life. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
Next speaker, I really appreciate another, a lot of appreciation here, but everybody, we've got a lot of people coming together for this. And Craig, if you could come on up. Craig Pusaro, PhD, is going to make a presentation on the risks, benefits, and uncertainties in doing a joint mapping project. And Craig has a wonderful reputation amongst us for being an independent, being able to walk that fine line, very, very fine line, between the industry and all the other interests. So I very much appreciate, Craig, you coming up and helping us out. And thank you very much.
Thanks, Rick. I appreciate that. As I said when I asked a question earlier, I do wear a few different hats, and one of them is as the Joint Oil and Fisheries Liaison Officer operating out of Santa Barbara, which was a conflict resolution service between commercial fishing fleets and the offshore oil industry in the Santa Barbara Channel and the Santa Maria Basin. So over the 23 years I've been doing that, I've gotten to know a few of the people in both industries, and we've had some tussles that are similarly difficult to work through. So I do have a little bit of experience trying to work with people through these difficult decisions. When John Richards, the Sea Grant Marine Advisor for this area, emeritus now, and Kerry and I were contacted by Chuck to talk with him about working on the Nature Conservancy proposal, my little brainstorm was, well, let's make sure everybody has their eyes open about what the benefits of working together can be, about what the risks are to fishermen in particular, you know, what, and I think everybody knows what I'm talking about when I say risks, the potential losses, economic losses, area losses, and so forth, and what the uncertainties are in the information that we need to make informed decisions about what areas can be protected while minimizing the economic impact of fishing. That's really, and I heard the earlier speaker here presenting that exact viewpoint. So we started, and a few people put down a little table here. Unfortunately, in a senior moment, I emailed Jay with the final table that everybody had input things into, but I forgot to put the attachment on the email. It's one of those things that, you know, happens in senior citizen history. So anyway, You don't have it as a handout right now. However, I think what we can do, and I think this is the way I'm going to handle this little section of our discussion today, is I'm going to point out a few things that either Chuck or I or Jay or Rick put down on this table. And then what I'd like to do is take that microphone and start it in the audience, and as these things trigger points in your minds about what the benefits are, what the risks are, what maybe, yeah, that's the way to do it is thank you.
Anybody wants to risk?
Sorry, Bob. So I think what I'm hearing is if anybody wants to respond or engage conversation with Craig, we'll pass you the mic.
Exactly, and actually I want to do it a little more organized way than that. But hang on to the mic.
Okay.
Let me point out a few of the things that several of us who met thought about. I'll just, there's maybe a dozen or 15 in each of these categories, benefits, risks, and uncertainty. I'll just pick some at random, okay? We may get trawl zones added back into the closed shelf areas. That's a possible benefit. If they're structured and sited properly, the trawl zones could provide certainty for fishermen going forward. No trawl zones could be credited for current and future marine reserves, RCAs, and other rockfish conservation areas, I imagine that means, and other proposed closures that we think are imminent. A proactive, aggressive conservation proposal by fishermen working with the conservation community would provide excellent public relations, and I presume that means for fishermen, which in my history, fishermen have never really been the best public relations risks. Proposed no-trawl zones might not be accepted by the council or NOAA Fisheries. Other environmental groups might oppose the final chart that fishermen and the Nature Conservancy comes up with. Yeah, that's a risk. Somehow this proprietary information gets in the wrong hands, which is the issue of trust that is a difficult one and that takes time. I have to say from personal experience, I told you I've been doing this since 1983. That's about 22, 23 years here. It wasn't for the first decade that anybody come up to me and say, oh, I know you, you're the guy, and start talking to me as if I were part of the community. So trust takes a long time, I guess, is the point of that story. But that is the idea. So people are concerned that you start building trust and you give somebody your proprietary information, then boom, goes to the wrong guy and they use it against you, and there you ruined all that good work that you tried to do. Another risk, if trawlers get locked into historic areas and the ocean changes, it does that, trawlers may no longer have access to areas required to harvest certain species. And that's a possibility. Risk, there will be sufficient overlap between the trawled area map and the defined sensitive areas or habitat areas of particular concern or low resiliency areas, that there's enough overlap that ocean conservation groups and the fishing industry can't find common ground, and eventually the conservation groups argue to close all trawling anyway. Well, I suppose that's a risk. And there are other risks. Uncertainties. Chuck mentioned this. We're under severe time constraints. If a group of trawlers that work this area were to agree to sit down with Chuck and Mary and do this mapping exercise for a small area, pilot area, you got to hustle. Time is short to get a meaningful proposal such as the kind of detail you saw in all these maps that everybody else has got out there. Time is short to get that level of detail into something that can be handed over to the council as another alternative. So that certainly is an uncertainty. Can you get it done? Can enough trawl fishermen participate? That's uncertain. How do you aggregate data from fishermen to mask confidential information? How long do the no-trawl areas go into effect? Are they forever, or are they like the current shelf and cow-cod rockfish conservation areas that are supposedly part of adaptive management, where we do things, then we learn by them, and then we adjust management as a result? What kind of ability do we have to include information on not just the A permit holders, but B permit and open access trawlers in crafting these trawl and no trawl zones. That's an uncertainty. And that also factors into this time problem that we're into. Another uncertainty, we don't know the extent to which the relatively extreme council and department management actions that have already been taken over the last few years, including the Calcod Conservation Area, the depth-based closure, the shelf closure, and the nearly 50% reduction via the buyback of the groundfish fleet, will already protect essential fish habitat to the degree required by Magnuson. Is the groundfish habitat risk already reduced to acceptable levels under the Magnuson Act by the measures that are already in place and that have just been put in place in the last few years? So that's an uncertainty. And actually, we can't know that by the time we have to comment on this DEIS, because they have not had time to take whatever effect they were intended to have. If we are talking about groundfish whose time to first spawning is 20, 25, 30 years, we can't know how these actions are going to affect those groundfish stocks and their supporting habitat in a matter of a week, a month, even 5 years. So there's a big level of uncertainty as to the areas that have already been closed, the reduction in effort that has already taken place, either through attrition, retirement, heart attacks, or buybacks, all of those things. We don't know how those are going to affect the level of impact on habitat or the groundfish stocks themselves. So there's a bunch of uncertainties that everybody can think of. And I think that this is the part of the program where it's best to, and I really appreciate the fact that this is being captured on tape, because this is an opportunity for everybody here, having heard a few of the things that other people put down in a little table here, if that's clicked something in your mind, it would be well if we captured that here on tape, so that once we get some final product about this, the risks, the benefits, the uncertainties, that it will be comprehensive and it will reflect what everybody thinks here. So, Rick, if you would be so kind as to start in the, hand it to the...
Let's take the rest of it off, and then we've got an MPA, we've got a non-extractive area. That's my real big concern over all these options, both Oceana and Nature Conservancy. They may be coming in good faith, they may be coming with real sincere optimism about what can be accomplished. But history has proven, Channel Islands is one example, that it doesn't usually end up working that way for our industry. It ends up being a continuous loss, and nothing is ever given back. We never give up an area and get it back. That doesn't occur. Positive side is, if it does work, it's a way to salvage the fishery, because we obviously have a big bullseye on us from a lot of segments. We all feel good about what we do. We're producers of seafood. We're one of the most managed and restricted seafood industries in the world. And a lot of the people who want to see us off the water have no problem with going and buying product from other countries that have absolutely no restrictions. Mexican fishermen who use dogs for chum. Asian fishermen who harvest porpoise along with their tuna. A lot of the people who profess to have good faith about wanting to protect the environment have no problem of buying products from countries like that. So to work with Chuck or with Oceana on a project like this and have it work out would be tremendous. I think it could really help help save our industry, have somebody producing fish off our coast in 10 or 20 years from now. And was there a third item, Craig?
Uncertainties? Things
you're... I think I expressed both of them just now. Stan?
Yeah, my only... It goes along with Craig's. My things are, it seems to be that they take a little bit now, then they take a little bit later. They keep taking and they keep taking. And one of my concerns would be, one of your positives was potentially the environmental groups could be the PR guys for the fishermen. Well, they've been doing PR for the fishermen for several years now, but it's been bad PR. They've been saying they're raping and pillaging the ocean, and to turn over the PR to the environmental groups would seem to be a big mistake.
I have a question about one of the things that you said, the very first thing. The very first one about something might be added back.
One of the listed benefits that someone put down
number one.
It isn't the first one, but it's the first one I pointed at. We may get trawl zones added back into the shelf areas.
And how?
All of those mechanisms go straight through the Pacific Fisheries Management Council. How would be through the council.
But what would be the reason? I don't understand. Those areas that are closed on the shelf are based on fish. This is something else.
Habitat. Based on habitat, right.
Right.
I don't want to second guess what the author of that particular point said, but let me see if I can anyway. If this mapping exercise is done, and there are some trawl zones and some no trawl zones, turns out the agreed on trawl areas are currently closed by the council, and they adopt this option 12, or what is it, 12?
10.
And they adopt option 10 as the preferred option, and they've already agreed that option 10 has these trawl zones in it, then by definition there would be some trawl zones that were closed by the shelf closure that would be reopened. If that becomes the preferred alternative. Did I miss something?
It doesn't make sense.
It's complicated. I agree with you.
It isn't complicated. It's very simple. It's two different things. Okay.
I don't understand how these groups are able to ignore the Rockfish Conservation Area and the Cowcod Conservation Area and the Channel Islands closures and all the areas inside 3 miles and say that we don't have no fishing zones and we need more no fishing zones. I've never seen anything given back to us ever in 30 years. There's promises, nothing ever comes back. Another negative is I was at those meetings when the federal government was assuring us that the Channel Islands Marine Sanctuary had no intention of messing with fishing. They just wanted a sanctuary from oil development. Well, we know what that has turned into. So, yes, I'm a little skeptical of promises. I know I could right now go down and take Oceana and Nature Conservancy and show them on a chart where there's big beds of coral, which, frankly, we don't fish in because of, like Don was saying, I never catch any fish. When I do end up in coral, there's no fish. Not commercial quantities of fish, and maybe like the pictures show, there's little tiny fish living. We don't want little tiny fish. We can't sell them.
Goals without understanding the true objectives that we're trying to reach, and in terms of the cost to the coastal communities, logistically, there just isn't time for them to give the kind of detail and specific and unique qualities that concern them most. There's no way to account for those things, and by the time these processes all come into play, much of that will be gone. And as you said, you know, cultural heritage of the coastal communities is something we're trying to understand, but we have no way of documenting it right now unless the fishermen can help to do that. We have no opportunity, time-wise, to take account of all of these different elements that we want to understand and protect.
Well, I have you're Jeff, right? The Oceana presentation seemed to make a lot of sense, provided that his concept is the one that Oceana and the rest of this organization comes along with, and that is that if we identify where the coral is and say, okay, that's off limits, I think the trawler fishermen would have no problem with that because they don't want to fish there anyhow. So that's okay. But the problem is, as the gentleman back in the back of the room pointed out, that, oh, we've identified the coral area, but now we're going to close out a whole bunch of good fishing area that doesn't contain coral. And although this gentleman here makes a lot of sense, some of the people that he works with and work with him may not have the same attitudes.
And that's my concern.
I had just a couple of questions here. You don't need to answer them, Craig, but they're more. I'm interested more in the mechanics and the process of this. And for one, all these alternatives, which is a whole mosaic of alternatives, and I'm unclear on this, when an alternative is established, does it apply for the whole Pacific Coast, or can certain regions kind of pick which alternative fits best for them and what is most appropriate for that particular region? Another comment I have, and it relates to the alternative C9, I believe, and that was the gear restrictions. And but from what I understand, a lot of the gear restrictions have already been implemented in our area. So with in those regards, do the fishermen get credits for that already? Because they're ahead of the curve on that. So because they've already implemented some element of conservation, do they still need to be subjected to full closures, et cetera, et cetera?
We came move to Morro Bay 8 years ago as a spot prawn boat and fished for spot prawns for many years here, and that was closed. And the closure of the spot prawn trawl fleet in Morro Bay was a big impact for the community here. We've just recently purchased a groundfish permit in order to be able to continue fishing a year ago, and have not actually fished that much in this particular area yet. My general concern with everything that's been talking about the trawl industry is you've been talking about obtaining information from the groundfish permits. There are a lot of other trawlers in the communities that have trawl areas, and by basing what you are looking at on the groundfish trawl areas, it's going to have an impact on those other trawlers, halibut, the ridgeback, the pink shrimp. And so you can't just use the logs from the groundfish. You need to also be talking to the other trawlers. There aren't that many of us, but there are there.
Maybe I could. The Fishermen and Conservation Collaboration that I see in the on your plus side is a plus, you know. I frankly would encourage it, but with the word trust, Chuck here, the Nature Conservancy is relatively new in Ocean Endeavors, if you will, at least new around here in Ocean Endeavors, and in the past, there was no collaboration. There was we're pretty old. They did a big survey, a very comprehensive survey, a few years ago, and it was 3 years ago. The results came in, and I was the average. I'm 58 years old now, so you can see where the future of the industry is going. If the average age, that was the salmon industry, by the way, you can see where the future of your industry is going if your average age is nearing 60. Not much of a future there. And there's a reason that there isn't any young people entering the fisheries. And it's because of the intense pressure that's been put on us for so many years. And without that happening, the fisheries will end up collapsing, and you can't just turn around to a younger generation and say, hey, we got a big void here in our food supply. Step up to the plate and go fishing. Oh, the know-how is gone. The know-how is buried with us in the ground. You know, it's not there. You can't just call it back. And then we will eventually rely on third world countries who, in many cases, are devastating their own environments. Because when you lose all the fishermen, you don't lose the demand for fish. You only lose the people producing the fish. The demand is still there. That demand will be supplied by somebody that's capitalist capitalism. That's how the world gets by. So, anyways, also one other thing was the time. The timeline has come up and come up and come up. Now, I'm not sure about the legalities that Noah is facing in coming up and meeting a timeline. But perhaps they could use the areas already closed, as mentioned before, the Osborne, the 43 Fathom, the Tanner Bank, the shelf closure, as I'm not saying to use that as necessarily 100% of meeting this timeline, but use it to delay the timeline. Because I would sure personally, and I'm sure everybody else would agree, that I hope common sense can overcome a timeline. If and I don't have to go on about all the adages of, you know, haste makes waste, rush to judgment, and I go on all day like that, but it's true. And if we are in a hurry to accomplish something, it will probably end up being sloppily done. And I've probably been windy enough.
You know, Jeremiah just said about 90% of what I was going to say. Age of the fishermen, rushed into the last-minute crisis that we have to do it by this date. Look what happened to the Channel Islands. Don't take zones by rushing into the last minute instead of working it out another few months that would have come to a good working thing. I think that trust is something that I haven't seen yet working with environmental groups. I haven't seen it working with sport fishing groups, commercial versus sport fishing. I don't see the trust. I see a couple people that I'm starting to trust a little bit in my life, and I've been involved in fishery politics probably for over 30 years. And I've got screwed by so many people I trusted during that period that it's hard for me to get any trust out of the deal. I've also seen one thing that would be to your advantage is that, and this has been in past legislation and stuff, where recreational fishermen and sport fishermen together have made an agreement with a group like yours, and I've seen the sport fishermen renege on it every time, and I've never seen the commercial fishermen renege on any agreement they ever make. Once you make an agreement with them, I think they keep their word. And I'm proud of that as a commercial fisherman to be able to say that, because you might have a little bit of trouble getting to that agreement, but once they agree on it, they don't break their agreement, where to me the other side breaks their agreement all the time. So trust is a big thing, and it's something that, like Craig said, it takes a while to earn trust. And trust between two parties is something that we have to have in the future if we're going to work together on this kind of stuff. And I don't think, you know, it's like Jeremiah said, I'm 67. So, you know, as you get a little older, you get a little bit smarter. And you know who to trust and who not to trust, and you have a little bit more. When you've got this thing in your head that you feel you can start trusting somebody, I think you'll see that older fishermen are going to have a little more trust in you if you're on the same wavelength with them. They're also going to be very cautious up to the point where you...
With the 22A trawl permit people from basically Pigeon Point South and whatnot, and I don't have one of those permits. I don't have any permit. I'm in the open access trawl. I'll have a permit at the end of this year. But I'm wondering, how come old Chuck don't come around and talk to me? Well, after I've seen Oceano's proposals, I know why. Because old Chuck knows that in a year, I'm not going to have any place to fish if that goes through. So, it's been a revelation this afternoon.
To your right there. I'd just like to add the importance and the significance of the existing closed areas. I don't think you can talk about them enough. There's just enough is enough. We have over 10,000 square miles of bottom closed to fishing
in the state of California. I'm sure the act is whatever the law requires. It's satisfied by that closure alone. So I think if we just focus on that, we'd realize that that's really all we need is just look at the existing closures we already have. Thank you.
Howie, Craig, did you want to? I'll give you something, then maybe I'll suggest that just to let you all know. The good news is, I think we're coming to the last program because after Craig's done, we got one more group to make a presentation on what some mapping we've done. But I'll give you my input. I think the benefits are pretty obvious. I think that we've got an opportunity to take some of the biggest benefit of all. If you ask me, is that we have tremendous uncertainty now in trawling especially, and no wonder folks with the Class A permits and like Bill are willing to sell out. Not only the age is right, but I mean they know that their future is very uncertain. And if I was in their spot, I don't blame them a bit for being very, very interested in that. But I think that this is a potential opportunity to maybe do something to solidify that. And it all comes down to, I mean, we have the same goals. We have many of the same goals with the conservation community. That really is clear. Where we go wrong, I think, is that you heard it today, is the trust thing, and where it goes somehow, you deal with a person, who seems like they tell you all the right things, and then you find out that they're bored or at the meeting or something else happened, and that's everybody's got that same story. So I would, kind of talk to Noah Nymphs if they really want to know. I think the biggest risk here, uncertainty, it's all tied together. The biggest negative and reason we can't get people to, it makes sense to try and do a collaborative thing. We'd get better maps. I don't see a whole lot of reason not to, frankly, except for the fact that we can't trust, we are not empowered. Myself as a community person, I have way more to do in the day than I can do, and I've done this as a sidelight and got up on it, and I'll have to drop it again next week and be on to the next thing. These guys got to go fishing. Most of these guys got to go fishing on Sunday, and they shouldn't be here right now because they should be getting ready to go fishing on Sunday. And yet Chuck and Jeff and all the folks there and other folks at Nature Conservancy Oceana will be at the PFMC meeting, be working on this. This will be their project, and they'll do what they want. Nothing pejorative about it. That's just the way it is. Well, you guys have the time and money to do whatever you want, and we don't. We can't keep up. We're not empowered in this process. So if NIMS really or somebody, that's the only way to breach the trust thing. I'm not sure exactly how, but that has to be changed somehow. Thanks. So Frank, you didn't want to say anything? Back to you, Craig.
Thanks. I think I'll wrap this up. I think I really appreciate the fact that everyone that wanted to say something about the risks, about the benefits, about the uncertainties got a chance to, and that is recorded now for everyone to hear and understand in the future. That was kind of my goal in this part of this discussion. So back to the moderator here in the next.
Okay. John, are you? Hate to say it, I see John kind of buried there in a conversation, but our next speaker is John Richards, UCC Grants Emeritus, also greatly respected by all of us. I've been in this business of helping commercial fishing for a long time. Carrie Culver is also here, and Mike Robinson, and maybe you'll introduce. So this will be our last presentation, unless we do really need...
With Jan.
I'm sorry, Jan. Pardon me, Jan. I forgot. And I'm looking at I think I'll go talk to the trawlers to see if they want to say something at the end of this, because I'd like to give them an opportunity, but I'm not sure they will.
Yes, thank you, Rick. I'm John Richards. I'm with the University of California, formerly Area Marine Advisor for Sea Grant. I covered the three counties here, San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara, and Ventura, starting around 1976, in the lease sales. They had no idea that there was fishing going on in terms of developing that lease sale. It was Frank Donahue, who's sitting over there, Captain Frank, Captain Ralph Hazard, and I went down to BLM and started some of the first mapping of fishing areas in the channel. And this was outlining trawl zone, ridgeback spot prawn areas and rockfish, flatfish areas in the channel. Several lease sales went on during the 70s and 80s, and that process continued on. The liaison office was developed. It continued on with Craig's office to do mapping of areas. And as drill rigs came in, fishermen were precluded, pipelines, platforms. So there are a lot of areas that are precluded, that trawlers are precluded from, particularly in the channel and also in the Santa Maria Basin. To jump ahead, in recent times with the sanctuary developing marine protected areas around the islands, channel islands, in the state waters, there was an effort to do some mapping of valuable fish habitat there. And several of the fishermen worked with the sanctuary. They developed a program called the MRWG, the Marine Reserve Working Group, to define some of these areas. And just in recent times, they've done some very good GIS work looking at the federal phase of this. And the fishermen were able to work with a person at UCSB called, her name is Dr. Barbara Walker. She's a social geographer. And also with Dr. Monica Hunter, who is here, to do some mapping of valuable habitats around the islands, in the channel, and then also up in this area, starting with a little work on groundfish. And this was also led by Frank Donahue, Ed Ewing. The Cable Committee funded a part of this. And Michael Robinson, who works with Dr. Barbara Walker, is here today. He's the GIS specialist who's been working with the fishermen on this. I'd like to bring Michael up to show you some of the work that's been done. There was a small amount of work here with the groundfish. We're hoping to expand it, but it hasn't gone that far, but there has been a small amount done. I'd also like to introduce, before I start with Michael, Jan Mason, who's with the National Fisheries Service up in the Pacific Fisheries Environmental Laboratory in Pacific Grove. And she's also done some GIS work, some local GIS work here and also on the Central Coast. And she will follow Michael. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
All right, good afternoon. My name is Michael Robinson. I'm a geography graduate student at UCSB Santa Barbara. And basically, about 3 years ago, I was introduced to Dr. Barbara Walker at UCSB, who was studying the effects of the marine reserves in the Channel Islands on the fishermen, and wanted someone to come in and just do GIS work for her. So I really came into the project just to help pay the bills and do some GIS work. But over the years, as I've been doing this and meeting people like Frank Donahue and Chris Miller out of Santa Barbara and Chris Hufflinger down in Ventura, Pete Helme down in San Diego, working with Monica and Diane Pleschner-Steele and Barbara, and interacting with the fishermen and with fishery scientists, I've been able to get, I think, an interesting perspective on some of the issues that are going on, and I've had an interesting role to play. And I just want to show you a little bit of that. Basically just brought some maps to show you some of the efforts, some of the questions that have been asked of the data that has been available, fairly easily available, and just look at some combinations of that and some things that may be able to be done fairly realistically with some of this information. So just briefly, kind of the original mapping efforts are what I was brought in to do, some what we're calling proactive fisherman mapping with some of the fishermen in Santa Barbara and Ventura area, and then kind of the projects that I'm working on now are part of my PhD research is actually modeling fisherman behavior, which I've been told is difficult to model, a bit chaotic at times, but again, with this idea of better informing these biocomplexity models and the analysis of the reserves, how can we get better information in? You know, the information you put into a model is the information you're going to get out. So if we can put better information in, hopefully we'll get more accurate reserves and better analyses of their placement. So original mapping efforts. Two main data sets that I was using, and these were handed to me on a bunch of disks. One was data from the fishermen, putting it on maps, and then aggregating it to hide or to mask proprietary information. You know, I don't want you to go to my exact fishing spot, but you can get a pretty good idea from this. The darker colors, again, being this overlap of fishing effort. The lighter areas, the yellows and light oranges, being a very little fishing effort. And then if you don't see any color, at least from these nine fishermen that were surveyed, there's no fishing effort in the other areas. Again, this is fairly biased towards Santa Barbara, if you're wondering. And then finally, the other idea was to look at the reserves, look at some of the overlap that's been talked about today. What happens when we start adding this and that and this and that and this and that on top of each other? What kind of areas are covered? What kind of areas remain? And how might this impact or affect fished areas or fishing effort? So basically, a couple things we wanted to look at, or a couple things, again, as a GIS tech, I sat down at the computer, and fishermen, scientists would come in and say, hey, let's try this, let's do that, let's zoom in, let's turn this layer on, let's hide that, and kind of look at some of these overlaps and look at these effects. So we basically wanted to address two main things at the onset. One was this effect of scale. Regulatory agencies often work at very large scales. A lot of the data we have is at these, you know, 10 mile by 10 mile or even 1 mile by 1 mile chunks, whereas a lot of times fishermen are fishing a very small area, a reef. Again, I was working primarily with lobster fishermen initially, so we're talking about fairly local areas that aren't captured well in 1 mile by 1 mile boxes or 10 mile by 10 mile boxes. And through this, we discovered some misalignment of data, which I'll briefly talk about. And then finally, this idea of regulatory overlap. So in cartographic terms, in map making, a small scale is a map that covers a really large area. So in this case, the Channel Islands is a fairly small scale map so that you can kind of see what's going on in the entire region. And then, again, in cartographic terms, a large scale map is when we zoom in on a particular area so that we can see detail, we can see differences, identify hot spots, focus on what we're doing or what's happening in a particular area. Again, just to give you an example, this might be a small-scale map. We're going to look at the entire channel. Now we're going to zoom in on Santa Rosa Island and see what's happening there. And finally, zoom in on Talcott Shoals, this reef off Santa Rosa Island. And by doing this, we can capture a lot more detail that is very difficult to capture on an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper of the entire channel, for example. And going back to this, for those of you that know Chris Miller, he proposed an idea, at least as we were chit-chatting, he proposed an idea. Let's take something like this and blow it up to the entire wall, and let's start drawing on something that resolution, that size, so we can really capture some of this detail, which is a problematic process at times. But again, this idea of let's really capture what's going on rather than look at 1 mile by 1 mile squares. So through this analysis, we noticed, or it was brought to my attention at least, that a noticeable portion of the economic data, of value being reported from these 1 mile by 1 mile squares, isn't in the correct place. Part of this because difficulty identifying a particular area on an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, and then again, some of it being intentional misrepresentation. I don't want to tell you exactly where I fish because one of two things, you might go fish there, or if I tell you the best spots, you know, you might close that down if you're looking for good spots to put a reserve. So I don't want to tell you exactly where I fish. But the idea is if we can improve the economic data, again, improve the data going into these analyses, into these maps, we're going to improve the accuracy of the biocomplexity models and improve the analysis from the reserves, from all the alternatives. So, again, here's an example. I've taken the ethnographic data, which you see basically the fishermen data. Here's where I fish, kind of overlapped, the yellow being maybe one or two people fish that particular area, the dark oranges and browns being many people fish that particular area. And overlaid on top of that are boxes of the economic data. So a clear box or an empty box is very low value reported from that particular square. Single hatches are medium value, and double hatches, which pretty much in this area, there's not very many double hatched boxes on here, would be reported as very high income coming from that particular 1 mile by 1 mile square. And as we zoom into Santa Rosa, and there's just a real rough outline, I don't see my mouse. Sorry. The black lines that you see are a real rough outline. They're not geo-referenced or anything, but the basic reefs out there. And what we wanted to do was look at, or what we were looking at, was how well the economic data matches up to this ethnographic data, or the fishing effort data. And we saw that, in general, it appears that the economic data is trying to capture the general area. Right? You see the single hatches, in general, are following that reef, or following the general area of where the fishing effort is. But there's a lot of misrepresented or misaligned data. And what we mean by that is, I'm saying the southeast side of Santa Rosa Island, tailed substrate habitat type data. You can't just hop online and download it. You can't just call somebody up and get it. There are some places that have it for particular areas. There are some kind of very coarse resolution data sets out there, but it's really, really hard to find high resolution data sets to do the analysis that we're attempting to do, or that we'd like to do. So the idea is, let's talk with the fishermen. Let's get information from them, which has been mentioned many times in this meeting today. And then the other one was, again, that idea of, let's look at the existing closures and kind of overlay them and see what's going on with those. So some of the things we did, this is a NOAA biogeographic assessment data set. And this is the region that we were mapping. And so it cuts off at the top. There's some more data at the top that has been removed just up around Monterey Bay, just because the map doesn't go up there. And then there's nothing down below that. The color ends at that line, because for this particular data set, that's the full extent of the data. It doesn't go south of there. But again, just trying to capture sand, rock, mud, substrate, or habitat types. And then a few fishermen here, trawlers, were interviewed and basically given a map, and just they were told to draw on this map what type of bottom exists in these areas. And this particular fisherman did it by bathymetry. You know, zero out to so many fathoms is sand, and so many fathoms out to another so many fathoms is mud, these sorts of things. Or here's the bank, certain areas of hard or rocky bottom. Another fisherman was more detailed, drew little areas. These little red areas are rocky, and these yellow areas are sandy. And then these maps were scanned into a computer, and the data was extracted from those maps, and shape files were created. Basically, this data is now in the computer, and can be overlaid and can be matched and can be, combined in different ways. Another project was to look at these, say, cable closures and RCA closures and Vandenberg closures. And this isn't all of the closures that exist, but this is quite a few of the closures for this particular area, and how many closures are already there, how much area is removed by these closures, and then finally, how do these, this is again one example of those habitat maps, how do these closures overlap, or how much area that is trawlable area could be already considered closed, and how much additional area, and these sorts of things, just questions and analyses that can be asked of this data. One of the other big concerns that relates very closely to that, again, down in the Channel Islands area, was to look at simply regulatory effort, okay, regulatory overlap that exists, again, which was mentioned quite a few times today. Here are three examples of regulations. In red, we have the marine protected areas. In yellow, gillnet closures. And in blue, the California Conservation Zone. And again, these may relate to different species. These may relate to different gear types. These are just looking at sort of accumulation or aggregation of closures. And something that we did is just sort of sum them all up, and let's look at how much additional area those marine protected areas around the Channel Islands are adding. And what you see in red are the little slivers of additional area, which some complained, why all this effort for a little tiny bit of extra area closed? And others said, well, we put the reserves where there was already a lot of closure, so it's not as much impact. And again, it depends on gear type, it depends on season, depends on fishery in some cases. The other thing we looked at was just simply displacement. Again, for the lobster fishermen that we were in contact with, three or four of the lobster fishermen that we were in contact with indicated that, look, now that I can no longer fish here, or now that the guys around me can no longer fish here, here's where they're going. And so just to kind of get a visual idea, impression of how this displacement is going to impact other areas, again, increasing the effort, increasing the fishing effort in other areas. Toward the end of one of my projects, we started talking with the fishermen, or the fishermen actually just came to us and said, hey, can we do this? And we started dragging these reserves around, drawing new reserves in, doing some just basic analysis. What kind of areas are we talking about here if we draw a big reserve here? And this is one of the early maps that came up after having a lot of the fishermen having read the scientific literature. You know, here are X, Y, and Z that we want included in a reserve, the substrate and bathymetry and whatever the case may be. They said, okay, well, what if we put them here, 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 and here to try and meet these requirements? And came up with quite a series of maps that were then, some of them were analyzed, some of them were just thinking out loud on a computer. But they realized that a lot of these, they were trying to change the state MPAs, and those are set, and or at least at the time when they were talking to people, they were basically told, you know, don't try and change the state ones. Let's just look at informing the federal process. So this is another one that they did where the hatched, dark black hatch lines are the state MPAs, the current MPAs, and the green kind of transparent areas are just proposed federal ones. Filtered through some sort of what we call a decision paradigm. Am I an optimizer? If I can fish, am I going to go? Or am I a satisficer? You know, I've done enough this week. I'm going to hang out with my kids or whatever the case may be. And then finally, that will help determine, you know, maybe a fishing location, and then feeds back into the model. And some conclusions so far. Again, just as I know data sharing, trust, these are huge issues that come up again and again and again. But the little bit that we have seen occurring is definitely improved communication between fishermen, among fishermen, as groups get together and start talking, start sharing, start proactively mapping and collecting data, but also improved communication between fishermen and regulators and scientists as this process continues. A huge plus is the fishermen involvement in this mapping process, is the fishermen collecting data. They're the ones that are out there day in and day out. You know, I might get out there once a year for a weekend or something. That's just a sliver, a snapshot, as opposed to what's going on. And this is summed up in a paper by Ray Hilborn that just came out. This idea of the fox guarding the hen house versus the farmer in charge of the farm. Through this process, there are definitely expanded data collection efforts, you know, a lot more people out there covering the area, and hopefully, end result, more efficient and realistic management practices. That's it. Thanks a lot. I didn't do any closures. Yeah, I'm just mapping data.
That's been closed a long time. Very productive areas. Where are they? They're all closed in our fishery.
Okay. Okay. Frank?
Hi.
Sir, I would, for videotape purposes, we need to pull on microphones.
Oh, okay. She's got
her.
Okay. But again, that just to bring home a point, again, I'm a grad student at UCSB mapping data, you know, kind of looking at combinations and working with fishermen and working with scientists and working with regulators and kind of everybody. And so I didn't close anything off. But I agree with you. Okay. And what was the question?
Well, I guess it's in the
mirror. Okay, sorry.
Having dove those islands a lot over the years, some of the most productive lobster areas, particularly for divers or also trapping, whatever, the lobsters are in certain areas, you put them in the closures. And, you know, they were put there by somebody, maybe not you, but those areas that are very productive are the ones that they decide they're going to study in their protected areas. I can't see what the point is unless they're trying to keep those areas for study areas because, anyway, that's all.
Okay.
I'd like to comment on that. Tell these guys here, I started working with Mike a couple years ago, and basically he's the he was a guy on the computer. So it took me all day to figure out. They asked me, well, what do you want to do? And I'm thinking, well, what do you want to know? Well, the program that we got going at UCSB was a fisherman's deal. And these guys just happened to be the computer guys and run the computer. And they asked what – I'm trying to explain it to the fishermen. It's just like a scientist giving a stick to a monkey, you know. And Barbara Walker is a social geographer, and she was giving us a stick, which was the computer stuff, to see what we'd do with it. What Michael was doing is he was just doing what – it took me all day to figure out. He kept asking me, well, what do you want to do? I'm saying, well, what do you want to know? Well, they were just there to help us do – you know, I mean, he was holding the stick. So the mapping and the information on some of this stuff was just the fisherman's idea to come up with it. Do you have that one where we compared the sanctuary – their ethnographic data to the real data?
We have
the economic data
it's basically this data set.
Yeah. So what happens when they — one of the things that we found out that really got us going on this thing was that the data that the sanctuary had was bogus. Is there a loud whistle on this thing? You guys hear a whistle? It's me.
I also want to comment and thank Michael for bringing the data here. I'm Monica Hunter, and for those of you that I haven't met yet, I had a chance to work with some of the local fishermen, and Frank Donahue and John Richards also helped to guide some of this. But I think Rick Algert mentioned something about a lack of empowerment for the fishing community in these regulatory processes that are going on now, mapping processes. I think can be a little bit different. GIS in particular offers the opportunity for the fishermen to engage in a process that normally is not available to them in terms of scientific analysis of fisheries data. It's very hard to add to the kind of statistical analysis that goes on that is very complex and is — it's not easy to sort out in the context of a hearing or a meeting. But for the fishermen to be able to speak in the language of maps, to fill in gaps, to provide information that they're aware of that isn't either accurately portrayed or is just fundamentally overlooked consistently, this is the kind of thing that can develop with through a GIS process that opens it up to fishermen to sit down and determine the kind of information that is not being brought to bear into decision-making processes that affects them, and that they have had very little opportunity to display or explain or bring in the kind of complexity that they have through their experience of decades of fishing, personal knowledge, and just general awareness of patterns and trends. For example, I've heard fishermen for years say, how can you take 1, 2, 3 year period of time and make some enormous decisions and determine that these are things that are going on when they know that it's a decade of pattern or several decades of patterns before you can understand it? I think the maps have an opportunity to help display some of that understanding. So I'm hoping the small project that we did here was truly a pilot study. It was an effort to open up this process to the fishermen here and to begin to develop the base maps for the area, because they had not been done as part of the Channel Islands effort. So Michael was able to collect the bathymetry, whatever we could develop from some of the resource agencies, to help develop just a basic set of maps. So that's as far as we got, and we're hoping that it'll be a valuable tool for this group in the future. Anybody else?
Okay. Sorry I missed. I'm not sure about that. The mapping is very interesting. I just want to say that the city of Morro Bay is going to be reviewing, commenting on the DEIS at the May 5th Harbor Advisory Board meeting at 7 o'clock in this room, and then we're going to recommend council, the City Council comment at their May 9th meeting. Anybody else next? Did you work your... Jan? Okay, right.
I'm not from this area. I don't even know what
the... Here, Jan. I'm sorry.
I'm from Monterey area, and I'm not familiar with two of the closures that I see on the map there. Could you tell me about the one going west from Morro Bay? Yeah, and the other one that curves down from San Luis area, yeah. Because I can't read the legend.
Sure. These are cable closures. So basically buffers related to cable lines.
Okay, good. Thanks.
Jenny, you're next.
Okay. Michael, thank you very much. I'm going to talk to you more. I think that's really neat to have you as a resource. I hope you aren't going to finish your PhD anytime soon.
I have a long time left.
I obviously, I'm not working in your interest.
Thank you. Thanks. Hi, I'm Jan Mason, and I'm with NOAA NIMS in Monterey area. And so, as I say, I'm not from here. I've been working on data up in the Monterey Bay area. Well, I've had a data set that goes from Cambria to Point Reyes. But when John Richards told me about this project that you were having, or the meeting that you were having, I thought maybe I could come and give a little information. I know it's getting late, so I'll try and make it sweet and to the point. The data that I have is from 2003, and fisheries have changed since then, I know, down here. And I'm going to five between the two ports, or five or six. So it's with the buyout, several boats were bought out, and I'd heard that. Okay, so what I'm going to show you, because I don't get current data, I get the most recent data I have is from 2003. This is up at Monterey Bay, just showing you the technique I used. I plotted set and haul points of the trawls, connected them with straight lines, which you don't fish straight lines, I know, but that's how a map can do it quickly and easily. And then calculated density from that. Next. How do I get next?
Okay.
Forward there. Okay. And this is showing the area up there that I had worked in most detail on, and showing the size of squares that I mapped to was this 2 kilometer, which is a little bit more than 1 nautical mile, and comparing that to the fishing trawl block. So you can see that my resolution is cutting these down to about 8 across per block, so that you can really see where some of that activity is happening right at the shelf break. And then you also see activity in quite shallow, and that's the halibut, California halibut trawl fishery. So both of these are in the data set that I used because it's fish and game logbook data and not just the limited entry trawl data. Oops. This is something I did up there to look at the different species groups, target species groups that were being fished. And you can see how clearly that shows that the halibut trawl is a different group than what's being fished off the shelf. And the bluer is more the rockfish group, and the pink is more the DTS complex. Okay, here's your area where you're going to get more interested. As I say, I only had 2003 data for this area, for this period. Up north, I go back to 97, but down here I had not been planning on mapping this area, and so I didn't have the data for the whole time period, and I know that makes a huge difference, so I'll get to that in a second. So we had 553 tows within this area, 3,000 tow hours. I'm showing the rockfish conservation area. That's one closed area that I knew about. This is one of the makeups of it. This is the 60 to 200 with Petrali exclusion version of it. I know it's shrunk a little bit since then. I'm showing the 3 nautical mile line because you can't trawl inside there either. And so those are two of the trawl areas that are areas that are closed. I didn't know about the cable closures, and those would go right out of Morro Bay and make a jog out of San Luis, it looks like. I'm showing it this way so it's aggregated data, not wanting to reveal anybody's confidential information. The 1,000-fathom contours in bold out there in dark blue. That's wrong thing I kept hitting. This is to show you what percentage of the effort in that 1 year came from these different areas. So, 23% for a couple areas, 3% for that halibut area in real close of the fishing hours that were going on there, and you can see that, you know, these are some of the key areas where people are trawling, and whether those are kept open or whether those are kept closed, this is how much fishing went on in those areas in that year. And I'd like to extend it farther back. If you were going to use this for some sort of analysis of the effort, I think it should cover several years and not just 1 year, definitely, because obviously the restrictions have been getting tighter and tighter, and less fishing has been allowed in more recent years. The quotas have been getting smaller and smaller. I'm not advocating any of the proposals, but wanted to put something on the map. I didn't realize so many were going to be presented by the different groups here today, and I think that's great to get to see as much as possible of what's being proposed. This shows you what the map looks like for the Oceana proposal, I believe, if I've got it right. They can correct me if I'm wrong. They're 12, 13, and 14, which is the same area, but with different amounts of different levels of what's permitted in there. So 12 was for closure to trawl only, 13 was to all bottom contact gear, and 14 is to all fishing. And that shows you that, you know, where the effort's concentrated, that about, you know, a quarter of it would be in that pink area, which is the closed Morro Ridge area in their proposal. And the green areas would still be open, and they don't colored yellow later. So that's all I wanted to show you, and hope that can be of help. Yeah. Questions?
Jan, Kathy just brought up something that of interest. How much of this data do you know is involved in the spot prawn trawl industry that no longer exists?
I would have to check into that. I don't know.
The reason we're bringing that up is that perhaps a lot of this data has no consequential bearing on the fisheries as they exist today. Even though the data comes from a very short time ago, the fisheries have now changed. Like I said, there's no spot prawn trawling allowed any longer. So if a lot of this data is from that fishery, it has no bearing on the
most
current
of this is
types
not
of
that
species.
Species, because I did plot it for species, but I couldn't tell you specifically unless I went back and looked at the
map. Okay, I just wanted to bring that
good point
to
because
attention.
You're right that there's been this shifting baseline of what's being fished and what's allowed to be fished for, and it makes a big difference in what you view as areas that were fished, yeah.
Right. Even in here, and I believe it's 12 from Oceana, one of the requirements, they want the tow line to be 8 inches. I believe it already is. So oftentimes the fisheries don't get credit for things they've already accomplished, and I believe the gentleman brought that up earlier also. So, okay, I just wanted to bring that.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jan, very much.
Okay, thank you.
My name is Frank Donahue. I had a question on, do you get data from the vessel monitoring system?
No, that's not been made available yet.
Is there a reason for why it's not? Or is it?
They still say, oh, wow, that's real new stuff, and we aren't giving that out to anybody.
Because you know, every trawl vessel has that monitoring system on it, and it would tell you exactly where they're at.
I talked to someone who takes it in, and they said, yeah, that's it'd be a while before that can be used.
Are they within the same NOAA, you know, the hierarchy, and who would be in charge of that to tell them whether they could do that or not?
You'd have to check with the people that I don't know who in the NOAA hierarchy controls the vessel monitoring data.
Yeah.
It's up in Northwest Region, but I don't know more than that.
I don't know. Maybe some of the I don't have that system for what I do, and I don't know if it's proprietary information that the boats gave that. You know, if they signed up for it, but
it might be.
It seems like it's be valuable information, and it's they must have complete records of where everybody's been since it's been in place. So
I got curious about that data too, but don't know when it'll be available.
Thanks, Jan, again for coming down very much. No, I actually have a question, too.
I'm
not sending you away. So this is based on fishing game block landings? Is that the...
This is based on fishing game trawl log books. The vessel operator says, I sat here, I hauled up here. Hmm. And so I have start and end points.
Okay.
On
the toe?
On each toe. And I'm not showing you... I'm showing you some of the toes there, and there's a start and end point for each toe.
And would this be the oldest, I mean, as far back as anybody's ever tried doing this, you think?
97 as far back as that's recorded, or been put into a database.
Because, you know, it kind of makes me think of, like, Michael's project, I think would be really interesting to do a ethnographic survey and find out, because I think we would find that the trawl grounds have continued to, you know, decrease, and now again you'd find Jeremiah brings up with the spot prawn, which we've probably got another drastic reduction.
You could go to the 10-minute blocks farther back, and those are kind of outlined in gray there. The 10-minute block resolution was in the data that was collected farther back, and so... you know, that's the blocks that you see in here in green. Mm-hmm. But you could take that back to, I don't know how far back, probably to the 80s.
Hmm. And so there's nobody, I mean, I know it'd be a lot of work, but the target species specific for toes and things, obviously, that breaking that out that way would be...
I got that.
Oh,
but
really?
I haven't, as I say, I've only got 1 year of data for your area, and I'd have to get working on that. I couldn't get that in a week or two.
This is pretty neat what you got
but
here.
But maybe it could be useful, you know.
Yeah. Species information is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think it could be very useful. Thank you. Another question?
Yeah, one last question, if you will.
Yeah.
I'm Dean Wendt. I'm a professor at Cal Poly. And I'm wondering if... And I unfortunately had to step out during your talk, but a question to both of you is, do you have equivalent data sets for fishing in state waters here?
Well, trawling's not allowed in state waters north of Conception. It is, and I do have it where it goes around the curve there for the halibut trawl fishery.
Right, so this is, I'm not
but,
speaking
but
just
trawling.
But
it's only
trawl
required to have logbooks in historically, I believe.
Right.
Have
other sorts of fishing that would occur in state waters? And I'm only saying this in terms of...
This is what Steve Copps was saying earlier, is that we don't really have a data set for the equivalent for the gillnet fishery, or they're just now developing one for the nearshore fishery.
Or what about recreational fisheries?
Recreational fishery, your best data set. I can talk with you later about that.
I think that'll just be important in the state effort that's currently underway, and I'm just wanting to make sure that there probably are links in providing teams of people that in this area that will be discussing this process.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great.
Great. How do I get out of it?
Thank you to all participating. Thank you for everybody hanging in. Especially thank you to AGP Video who disappeared on me. But Bob, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very, very much. All right, I guess where do you go from now? Obviously, we've had a lot of talk about potential collaborative projects. I hope people will at least entertain that discussion. I myself am convinced that this would be a productive thing to at least look into. And the city, as I said, will be trying to comment on the draft environmental impact statement over the next week or two. Anybody else want to say anything before you go? Thanks very much.